Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the regular meeting of the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, Lahan Region. My name is Don Jardine. I'm from Markenville, and I am the chairman. I want to thank members of the public for coming to our meeting. You do a better job when you participate in issues that come before us. At this time, I'd like to introduce other members of the regional board. Dr. Amy Horn from Truckee. Peter Humphrey from Bishop. Eric Sandell from Truckee. Keith Dias from Rosemont. Unfortunately, Jim Clark is not able to make our meeting this evening. The executive officer is Harold Singer. Mr. Singer, would you please introduce the staff?
Yes, thank you. Let me know in the back, Barry, you're back there. If you can't hear, just raise your hand because we only have a few mics at this point. Okay, great. Wanted to introduce Sue Gennaro. Sue is the board secretary. If you have any questions this evening about what's happening, if you want to put in a speaker card, if you would give it to Sue and she will bring it up in front. If you have a question that she can't answer, she'll find a staff person and hopefully we'll get an answer for you for your question. But if you can direct most of your questions over to Sue, we'd appreciate that. I want to introduce Lori Kemper, the Assistant Executive Officer, Mike Plasiak, Doug Smith, Chuck Curtis, Doug Cushman, Richard Booth, Bruce Warden, George Sella, Eric Taxer in the back, and Emily Miller. Emily's one of our student assistants who's also coming with us tonight to observe. And I'd like to introduce Kim Niemeyer. Kim is on the staff of the State Water Resources Control Board and is the board's attorney.
Thank you. The regional board will be considering many items during this meeting. Although we must use our time wisely, we encourage your input on any items so that our decision will be based on all available information. If you wish to speak to any on any agenda item, please fill out an orange card indicating which item you wish to address and how many minutes you need. Although we do not administer an oath in most proceedings before this board, we expect all statements to be made before this board to be truthful, with no attempts to mislead by false statements, deceptive presentation, or failure to include essential information. We also ask you obey our ground rules, which are: treat everyone with respect. This includes board members, board staff, anyone who testifies, and your fellow citizens. This means no personal attacks and no violent, contemptuous, or disruptive behavior. In the interest of everyone's time, please communicate your ideas clearly and efficiently so that we can develop an accurate administrative record. We ask that you speak only after you are recognized. At that time, please come to the lectern and speak to the agenda item. If you do not follow these rules or become repetitious, I may ask you to sit down. Any person aggrieved by any action or inaction of the regional board, including but not limited to the issuance, modification, or rejection of a waste discharge requirements, administrative civil liability, or a cease and desist order, may petition the State Water Resources Control Board to review the decision. The State Board must receive the petition within 30 days of the Regional Board's meeting at which the action was taken. Board staff will provide you with copies of the regulations about filing petitions if you request them. They are also available on the State Water Resources Control Board's website. I'll take up item one, public forum. Any person may address the water board regarding a matter within the water board's jurisdiction that is not related to an item on this meeting agenda. Comments will generally be limited to 5 minutes, unless otherwise directed by the chair. Any person wishing to make a longer presentation should contact the executive officer at least 10 days prior to the meeting. Comments regarding matters that are under development for future meetings will be restricted. Is there anyone from the public who wishes to address the Water Board? Item 2, minutes.
I'll make a motion. We approve the minutes.
Second.
Motion, second, discussion.
I would like to amend, make two changes. One is easy one on page 5. I've always seen I written A-Y-E, not E-Y-E. So yes, under page 5, halfway down the page.
Okay. Yeah, you're right.
And then on page 3, I think what I would, Sue, I'll just write this out for you and give it to you, but when I gave the board report about and handed out the map of solar projects on BLM land, what I said was I wanted information about the subject of solar and wind projects in general, not just ones that might be on BLM land, and the impact they may have on water quality, and that what I heard the staff say is that the staff would provide a report or presentation at a future board meeting, so it's not specific. So a few changes in there. I'll write it out for you.
Okay, sure.
How I'd like it to be.
Is that change okay with the maker of the motion?
Yes, it is.
And the second?
Yes.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you, Amy, for those observations. I'll go to item 3, reports. Forest research information item.
Doug Smith will be the MC on this item.
Well, it's on. Okay. Board members, chair, and public, my name is Doug Smith, supervising geologist at the board. There are a couple of people who I'd like to introduce. They will present some information for you. The first speaker will be Michael Hogan. He's a soil scientist and researcher with Integrated Environmental Restoration Services. And he has a short presentation, probably 15 minutes, maybe a little bit less. There'll be time for some questions. And then after Michael, then Sue Norman will come up. She doesn't have any slides, but she will talk about the Forest Service plans working forward to meet the TMDL requirements. And then after Sue, then I will come back up, and I have 4 slides. I made a copy of those slides. Either it's color, both pages, and I will probably talk for maybe 10 minutes.
You should have it right
there. There will be time for some questions after that. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Michael Hogan.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to share a little information. The purpose of my presentation is to provide a little bit of description of a project we're working on to produce a handbook that addresses forest vegetation practices and water quality, the linkage between the two directly, and to present some outcomes of previous field research work that set the foundation for this handbook. I'm not going to get into a lot or probably any of the actual forest research we've been doing. That's probably for a later date. One of the questions that's come up about this handbook is, do we need another forest handbook? How many do we have? This was just a small smattering of ones I could find searching around on the web. Perhaps not, except that it's been suggested that there, by a number of individuals and groups, that we may need to shift or enhance the way we bring projects to completion. And I'll get into that in a little bit. One of the bits of, perspective I'd like to offer is that I think in bringing projects to completion, permitting them, getting them to go forward, finding the common ground that we need to find, may not be as difficult as it sometimes seems. So that's sort of a foundational piece of this. I'd like to offer some perspective or context on how we see this all happening. There's a couple of ways in my mind that projects are produced and brought to completion. The first one is on the left, which is what you might call top-down or predictive. And these aren't exclusive. But this process is based on things like models, expert opinion, common practice, assumptions, common sense, you'll often hear, BMPs. All of these things are put into a project plan with the idea that with the best information, we can get the best project. A lot of times what happens is it either the process of really planning and understanding whether the project works sort of stops there, and the little smiley face suggests that we just believe that the models and the predictions that we've come up with are going to work because we put a lot of front-end work into it. So that's one way. I'm not trying to judge these good or bad. The other one, in this extremely expensive, sophisticated graphic that I have here, is called sort of a collaborative or proactive approach. And without going into great detail, one of the reasons that the little graphic around proactive is so sketchy, it's a little bit harder to get to. It's a little bit pricklier. It's not quite as clean as a number that comes out of a model. However, the intent of this type of process is to get to the actual outcome and to understand it. And you'll see the little linkage there that's so important is assessment. And a lot of times in projects that are developed with EIRs that are permitted that move forward, there may not be enough assessment to actually understand whether what we thought was going to happen actually happened. So why don't we check more often? Why don't we do that, some of that monitoring? One of the things that comes up is cost. Another is time. We don't have enough time to do it. Cost is a big one. But there's another one, the possibility of being wrong. And I'm just going to throw this out because it's very thought-provoking and it's a foundation of a lot of the rest of what I'm going to talk about. This is, by the way, an amazing book by Catherine Schultz about being wrong and the power of being wrong and how it can be used to actually enhance the goals that we're trying to reach. One of the things that Catherine Schultz says is that being wrong feels just like being right. When you're wrong, it feels like being right. And this is a graph of new home sales, you can see, from 90 to 2006. And, you know, there have been a number of us who decided somewhere along that uphill trend that the trend was going to go forward and continue upward. And some of the models showed it, and we bought our houses. And then the rest happened. We tried to come up with something that would work. We followed the models, and yet the reality came out somewhat different. And I think it's just an example of how we can be wrong and some of the costs involved. There's some other possibilities. This is a possibility of adaptive management, what we're starting to call outcome-based management. And I'm not going to go into the details of this, but the idea is with this process, it allows us to actually get to an outcome in a way that we can do it systematically and understand a little bit of what we don't know and learn on the way and really understand truly whether we get there. The main thing, the first thing, is to figure out what the goals are. And this is the hardest one, to find out or see what we don't know. We often don't know what we don't know. It's one of those conundrums. And we move forward anyway. This process allows us to embrace that. Typically we say, yeah, I know, I've been doing this for 30 years, this is how it's going to go, and let's move forward. And the big part here is monitoring and evaluating and then assessing those monitoring results so that we can really test to see if it's going the way we thought it was going to go. A lot of what I'm talking about is based on a lot of work that we did that actually one of the board members had a significant role in. Called the Sediment Source Control Handbook. We worked with the Lahontan staff and ski areas to develop this adaptive management process into a set of tools that people could actually put into place and use and understand a little bit better and feel perhaps a little bit less risky in terms of the things that they don't know. And really what we're talking about is a way to manage risk. Understanding that we don't know something up front is a really powerful way to manage risk. We'll talk a little bit more about that. So, without getting into great detail, because I only have a few minutes to talk about this, I wanted to give some examples that we have actually been working on in and around the Tahoe Basin and elsewhere that has allowed us to achieve results that haven't previously been achieved on sediment source control, on water quality protection from uplands by using this process. One of the mantras of this whole process is, I believe you, now show me. It's one thing to be believed, it's another one to actually have to go out and test it out on the ground. Typically, when we're trying to control the source of erosion from uplands, a standard BMP has been and continues to be hydroseeding on relatively disturbed soils, spraying on a seed mixture, and hoping for the best. We've been doing this for 30 years. Actually, the data that we've been collecting shows clearly that in very poor soils, it simply doesn't produce the results that we'd like to produce. And the idea is not to say that's a bad tool. We're trying to get tools that actually work where they're supposed to work, and if they don't, let's improve them. And that's been the nature of the work that I've been involved in for the last few years. This is just a picture of a place up at North Star that was a road typical of many roads, and this is the results. This is all native grasses and shrubs coming up. This is another right-of-way on Highway 267, an area that had been failed to revegetate for a number of years. I should just mention that what we've done is, instead of looking specifically at trying to grow plants, we're trying to reinvigorate the soil. The model suggests that plants will control erosion, but the reality shows us clearly by direct monitoring that it's the soil that is a primary variable in controlling erosion. So we address fixing the soil, and by the way, the plants can't help but grow when that happens. This is another project we did at the Ponderosa Ranch with bare decomposed granite soil. Oops, this thing is forwarding itself. Again, you know, this has been, people have said, impossible to revegetate this kind of really disturbed bare decomposed granite soil. And I'm not trying to brag so much as just to say that some of these things can be tested and put on the ground. We made a number of mistakes getting there, so we didn't just walk out one day and magically wave our wand. But this is another one on Cave Rock, granite soil, 1 1/4 to 1 slopes. And this is what it looked like. This was irrigated for a while. I wanted to just suggest, since I'm running through this stuff very fast, that we have data to support a lot of this. I'm not going to even talk about what this data is. It's not enough to really just go out and do the work and say, look, it's growing. We need to get data. We need to understand to support some of these processes so that we feel less risky as we go forward in recommending them. These, by the way, were produced with using a rainfall simulator and a number of other tools that are relatively simple to use to get the actual amount of sediment that comes off of these projects. It's something that hadn't been done before. We assumed that we had grass. We're not going to get sediment. We've shown now that you can have a fairly significant cover of grass or other vegetation and still get a very large amount of sediment unless the soil is fixed properly. And again, you know, we're looking at a fairly non-vegetated and a fully vegetated area with about the same amount of sediment coming off. The data, direct measurement shows that's the case sometimes. The point of all this, I think, is to say that by doing a little measurement to test our hypotheses, when I saw that this lower site produced as much sediment as the upper site, it started to shift my worldview a little bit, because I hardly could believe it except I saw it. And this is one of those things that science can be so powerful if we test our assumptions and then go out and measure some things. And then one of the connections is to try and find cost-effective monitoring methodologies that can be used across the board that doesn't take a research project to support whether you're getting to your goals. And so there's a number of things that we use. A cone penetrometer, very powerful, very easy to use, and very understandable to almost anybody. Very simple water content methodologies. This is a cover point methodology we've come up with for vegetation, soil shear strength. Anyway, these are all just tools that very clearly and cleanly indicate whether you're on the right track to try and achieve your goals. So once again, this is the adaptive management model. One of the things that is, in my mind, required to turn this into a successful outcome, a successful project, are things like ownership of the process. It's hard to hand it off. Someone along the line needs to own the outcome, an entity, a person, whatever it happens to be. Clarity of purpose, which is where, you know, the goals are so important. A solid strategy, a clear, useful assessment. Flexibility. And this process, when applied properly, allows the flexibility between, say, agencies or entities trying to get a project done, as long as the goals are adhered to and clearly aimed at. Eyes on the goal and focus on the outcome. It's a really critical piece of the puzzle. So in the end, what we're trying to produce now is a handbook. Sorry, I'll go through these real quick. A handbook based on or similar to some of the concepts that were outlined in the Sediment Source Control Handbook for forestry practices. We're just beginning on this. We've been doing some forestry research for a couple of years. We've done a lot of forest uplands research for over 10 years. Worked on the Tahoe TMDL. And the idea is to create a tool, not a regulatory tool necessarily, but a tool that people can use to find that common ground, to build it to an actual outcome, and to understand how that goes. We suspect that probably working with some of the partners in the Tahoe Basin, we'll have this tool available for initial look in about a year and a half. So, I don't have much time to talk about, 20 years worth of work, but I wanted to leave a parting thought, and this is sort of one of my mantras. And we talked today about a number of things out in the field. One of the things that was talked about is that roads after a while will heal themselves and this and that. And I think that's true some of the time. We've seen that be not the case at times. We've actually seen old forest roads that hadn't been used in 25 years that had mature shrub stand on them that produced as much sediment as a road that had been currently driven on. That's not always the case, just as vegetation not controlling erosion is not always the case. But so much of what we need to really get to that level of feeling that our risk is carefully controlled and minimized is to really turn some of these things that we think we know into hypotheses, test them, and be able to understand as we move forward. And so this is Mark Twain. Like I said, one of my favorite quotes, it's not what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure. It just ain't so.
Before you leave, does any board member have a quick question? I found it fascinating. Thank you.
Board Chair, my name is Lori Cooper. I'm the Assistant Executive Officer. I just wanted, because I just think for the record and for a lot of people in the room who don't know Mike Hogan and why we asked him to come today. He, as you mentioned, he's been involved in different projects that the Water Board has either hired him directly or hired him. He's been a subcontractor on some larger projects. But specifically, just to remind the board, but also people in the room, he is working with us in spending the supplemental environmental project dollars that were associated with the $2 million penalty against North Star for violations from their past construction sites. So this is part of his effort, working with the North Star Fire District and the Waddell Ranch property to do watershed assessment and forestry assessment and working on handbooks. So I just wanted, mostly for the people here tonight, to understand why we asked him to come. And we do intend to bring back, probably this fall, more details of the work he's been doing for the board to make some decisions about future use of the remaining pot of money. So that tonight was just an information item, and you'll have a decision to think about later this calendar year.
Thanks, Lori, and thanks, Michael. So at this time, before I launch into my four slides, I'm going to ask Sue Norman from the Forest Service to come up.
She didn't have any slides, right?
No, she didn't have any slides.
Yes. So again, I'm Sue Norman. I'm the Fiscal Sciences Group Leader at the Lake Tahoe Basin. I've been working in our monitoring programs for almost 20 years. In your board packet, did you guys get a list of our reports, monitoring reports, bibliography? Mm-hmm. Does that sound familiar?
I did not.
It's a handout, though.
I handed this out.
Oh, okay.
The one that
I gave it to I thought maybe you guys could, but anyway, it's posted on our website, so it's easy enough to get to. On our website, we have over 50 monitoring reports posted. Reports older than 2006 are no longer on the website, but are included in the posted comprehensive bibliography dating back to 1991. So we've got a lot of our results out there, very easily accessible now with the wonders of the web. Today I'm going to talk about the soil water component of our monitoring program and the relationship of that program to the Lake Tahoe TMDL. The physical sciences monitoring program consists of a variety of protocols to conduct implementation and effectiveness monitoring. And over the past decade, through our participation in the development of Lake Tahoe TMDL, the program has also been designed with TMDL tracking and reporting in mind. Therefore, the program is designed to serve dual purposes, to provide information to the management unit to ensure consistent and effective use of best management practices, protect soil and water resources, as well as information to document the effectiveness of forest management activities to minimize or reduce sediment loading from upland source categories for both our forest plan monitoring and TMDL tracking and reporting. The management unit has recently agreed through conversations with Doug Smith of your staff to initiate a voluntary effort to develop a proposal for upland source area TMDL tracking and reporting for the Lake Tahoe Basin. I believe Doug has asked us to initiate this effort because of our long track record and the depth of our existing monitoring program. This volunteer effort will follow guidance as provided in the Lake Tahoe TMDL to develop a consistent and coordinated approach among all the major upland land management agencies and counsel with staff from the three TMDL regulatory agencies, Lahontan, NDEP, and EPA. The management unit is currently conducting an internal review of a draft proposal I have prepared, which will then be refined through coordination with other upland land management agencies prior to presenting to the TMDL regulatory partners for final consideration and adjustment. These protocols, missed a page here. My draft TMDL tracking and reporting proposal relies heavily on current monitoring reporting programs already in place at the management unit and are based on established peer-reviewed methods and protocols. Much of the information generated from these existing programs has been available on our website for the past several years, but as presented in the proposal would be packaged in a way that provides consolidated information related to the TMDL milestones for upland sources. It therefore involves creating minimal new work or additional costs to U.S. Forest Service budgets or to taxpayers. Another goal of the proposed approach is to coordinate with other upland land management agencies so that their existing programs can also be incorporated, and the more sophisticated and costly effectiveness monitoring performed by agencies with more resources can be used to report on upland source area activities holistically when those same activities are conducted by entities with less funding. Because the agenda topic coming up is the South Shore Fuels Reduction and Healthy Forest Restoration Project, the following is a brief summary of our existing implementation and effectiveness monitoring soil and water programs related to forest health management activities. Documented visual observations. These protocols rely on visual on-the-ground surveys to evaluate if PMPs are in place, if they are being used the way they were designed or in a way that makes sense in a given situation, and are they visibly effective in preventing accelerated erosion and sediment transport? There is simply no substitute for this type of monitoring, and it should be done widely and often. This information is used to identify technical and administrative deficiencies, as well as the need for adaptive management if unforeseen hydrologic responses or events occur. There are two existing protocols for conducting this type of monitoring: implementation checklist, which is a requirement in the 2009 timber waiver, and then the Region 5 Best Management Practices Evaluation Program, or BMPEP, which is also part of the 2009 Timber Waiver. This is the BMPEP is a Forest Service Region 5 program and has been carried throughout California and all the national forests. It's been in place since 1992. It includes annual randomly selected regional targets as well as additional project level monitoring at high risk sites. For the past 2 years, BMPs on the Lake Tahoe Basin have rated at 95% effectiveness. The U.S. Forest Service Chief is scheduled to roll out the new National Core BMP program and technical guide during the latter half of April this year, soon to be followed with a monitoring technical guide for that core BMP program as well. This national program is an offshoot of the Region 5 BMP program. Our program I believe was what stimulated this desire to have a national program like what we've been doing in Region 5 for a long time. It is expected to be complementary to and not replace the Region 5 handbook and BMPEP monitoring program. But we'd have two different agency programs that would be carried throughout both Region 5 and the Forest Service nationally. Quantitative effectiveness monitoring. This information is collected to measure the degree to which BMPs were effective in protecting soil and water quality. Depending on the nature and scale of activity and potential watershed response, this can include a variety of monitoring metrics, such as water quality data, comprehensive stream channel condition inventories, or specific metrics such as macroinvertebrates or shade. The level at which this type of monitoring is performed for a particular project is based on project environmental analysis and evaluation of risk, as well as the consideration of existing in-stream monitoring data. Because of the sensitivity of Lake Tahoe as it relates to fine sediment loading, in the past several years, the Forest Service has relied on a more direct measure of watershed impact and forest health management activities on watershed response through a programmatic soil quality monitoring program. The LTBMU soil quality monitoring program has generated data on the impacts of using cut-to-length forwarder harvester systems on a variety of Tahoe Basin soil types, including those within SEZs, on infiltration capacity, soil compaction, and soil cover. This post-project field data was then input into existing watershed erosion prediction project or WEP field slope models to predict change in runoff and sediment transport response over a 30-year climate regime. There are currently four separate monitoring reports available on our website that present the results of this analysis, and a synthesis of those results from all four of those efforts should be available in the next few weeks. This data continues to support the findings generated in research conducted outside the basin in that this type of low ground pressure equipment can be operated on the relatively coarse grained soils in the Tahoe Basin under dry or even moist soils without causing accelerated erosion or increases in runoff and sediment transport. This type of monitoring approach will continue to be part of our adaptive management monitoring program as new scenarios arise that need to be evaluated. In summation, our existing monitoring programs have helped to validate the design of our projects as well as informed us on how to improve the effectiveness of our design, including when additional measures are needed to obtain desired outcomes. These programs will continue to evolve as informed through advances in both research and technology. These programs will continue to achieve our forest goal of informing the design and adaptive management of our projects, as well as achieve the tracking and reporting goals in the Tahoe TMDL to provide relevant information regarding to the effects of forest management activities on fine sediment loading from upland source areas. We look forward to continuing to work with our land management agency land management partners, as well as the TMDL regulatory agencies as we move forward with this process. And I'll take any questions you might have at this time.
Dr. Horn.
Mr. Crawford.
No, thank you.
Harold, do you have any questions? Well, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Sue. Thanks, Sue. Lots of Sue's there. Here we go. Okay. Sue Norman had referred to a bibliography. I did not provide that to you, but I did provide you a two-page list of some of the research projects going on in the Tahoe Basin since 2007, and it's about almost $6 million worth of research. This isn't everything, but it's a big part of it. And some of these are done, and most of them are underway. So, hoping for that one to come up. Yeah, it's coming up slowly. We're doing okay. I think we're good on time. So, I'm here because of a project that we've been working on as part of the TMDL program. We've been working with US EPA on this. And it just so happened that the draft report landed on our desks less than 10 days ago. So we had to quickly go through this, see what's going on, and we wanted to report some of the findings to you. So let me kind of give you a little bit of background on this. Back when the Water Board was working on the Lake Tahoe TMDL, we used the Lake Tahoe watershed model, which was developed by Tetra Tech. It's a nationwide model, and we used that to model the sediment or the source loading from the uplands, from the urban uplands and the forested uplands. And we came up with a baseline load as of 2004. And then what we did as part of the TMDL implementation plan is we looked at what are the possible load reduction activities that we can implement and see what kind of load reductions we can get from those. And we didn't use the Lake Tahoe watershed model on that. We used other modeling efforts. We had experts, Michael Hogan. We had U.S. Forest Service experts. We convened lots of experts. That was the pollutant reduction opportunity report. And we came up with these activities that the forest management agencies are expected or are planned to conduct over the next 10 to 20 years, restoration projects, PMP retrofit projects, and those types of projects would get a 12% load reduction over that time. Load 12% reduction in the forested source. However, during that time, we also learned that the Forest Service was planning a more aggressive fuel reduction strategy, different than the fuel reduction projects that we had anticipated. And so what we wanted to do with US EPA's input or help is we wanted to put those that changed project into the Lake Tahoe watershed model and see if there was a signal, see if there was a difference in loading. So we floated this idea out. There was a lot of public concern about this larger project that the Forest Service was planning and that we didn't consider it as part of the Lake Tahoe TMDL. So we formed the concept in 2009, and US EPA funded this, funded Tetra Tech to put in these inputs into the model and see, let's see what happens to it. Well, as these things happened, it took a while to get the contract in place, to get things going. Everybody was scrambling as hard. It wasn't the best financial time for both the federal government, for the state. It was very tough. But US EPA did come forward, and it was great that they did this. So the modeling began right about time when the Lake Tahoe TMDL was adopted by the regional board. Then in 2011, the Forest Service had refined their project that included the South Shore Project. They had a lot of details on their GIS maps. So what they did is they were able to take those GIS layers and give them to Tetra Tech. And so Tetra Tech had the most current information. So they were able to put all those layers into their Lake Tahoe watershed model. And then lo and behold, less than 10 days ago, we got the draft report. Okay. So I need to state some of these assumptions, and I've already laid out a little bit dealing with the Lake Tahoe TMDL. What happened in the Lake Tahoe TMDL is there was a baseline load as of 2004. And then there were activities that the forest management agencies had planned, these restoration projects and BMP retrofit projects, dealing with ski runs, campgrounds, legacy roads and trails, all sorts of things, including fuel reduction projects. But what our TMDL implementation plan estimated was that about 15% of the basin would be treated for fuel reduction. And so that equated to about 25,000 acres. And we didn't know exactly what method was going to be used, whether it was going to be hand crews or cut-to-length methods or whole tree skidding, you know, with the skid trails. And so we picked the middle one. We picked all 25,000 acres with cut-to-length. Now, of those fuel restoration projects, two-thirds of them would get standard BMPs. That's water bars, some stabilization, and the other third would get advanced BMPs. That's basically full decommissioning, the tilling, the mulching, and all that. So it like, goes away. That's what is in the Lake Tahoe TMDL strategy. What the modeling did, what Tetra Tech did, is they did their analysis and compared it to the baseline. They did not do their analysis and compare it to our expected 12% load reduction. So the maps provided by the Forest Service equated to about 68,000 acres, and it was a combination of cut-to-length, hand crews, and full tree skidding. About half of that 68,000, roughly, was to be done by hand crews, and then the remaining quarters, whole tree skidding, and then cut to length. The other thing that the modeling does, and we did this on purpose, is we modeled this as if all 68,000 acres were done at once. And the reason why we did this is back after the Angora fire, if you remember, there was a big outcry that we needed a big influx of money so that all these areas could be treated immediately. And so we wanted to model, this is the worst case scenario, it all done at once. The other thing that the watershed model didn't do is that they didn't include the decommissioning of roads and old landings. It did not include any advanced BMPs, just standard BMPs. Water bars, some armoring, but no revegetation, things like that. And there was no mitigation for putting roads through SEZs. So it's really a worst case scenario. So we expected it was going to be worst case. And lo and behold, what the draft report found was that about 36% increase in total sediment load above the 2004 baseline, and about a 12% increase in fine sediment particles over the 2004 baseline, if all those assumptions that I just went over held true. What that meant for the South Shore project is that it possibly doubled the total sediment load, so about 100% increase, and it adds maybe about 0.15% fine sediment particle. Think, well, why not 100%? Well, fine sediment particles, the majority of them come from the volcanic areas of the Lake Tahoe Basin, which are mostly up in the northwest regions. The South Shore Project is largely granitic and alluvial type soils, and so it's a lot coarser. So there's less fine sediment particles there, but still very important. And what the model also found is that the greatest influence was the density of roads, skid trails, and landings, and that the skid trails really had the greatest ability to deliver sediment. So waterboard staff looking at this, trying to make heads or tails of what does this mean? Well, this means for fuel reduction projects basin-wide that SEZ protection, mitigation, and restoration, highly important. And there we have in the basin plan, there are there's regulations in there that have to be adhered to. There are prohibitions, mitigation requirements. And it's also important that advanced BMPs are added into these fuel reduction projects. So when temporary roads are put in, that those temporary roads are taken out. And they're taken out with advanced BMPs, tilling and mulching. And the skid trails. So, very important for the to be consistent with the Tahoe TMDL implementation strategy. So, I don't expect you all to go through, you know, the all 100 pages or whatever, 78, 79 pages of that. And we're still working with Tetra Tech on reviewing some of this. So it is draft, but we wanted to share it with you because we don't want to, you know, say that nothing existed. This is an effort that we've been believing in. We wanted to tell the public, here's what happens if you don't do these BMPs. Very important. So with that, do you have any questions about this?
Keith, do you have any?
No.
Dr. Holmes.
Too much information right away. Yeah, believe me, we're...
Oh, yeah.
So,
do you have any questions? Thank you.
Well, actually, in the conclusions, it seems to be saying that the wet model is systematically underestimating the amount of runoff from fuel treatments. So, if that's the case, then these summary findings you presented are systematically underestimating the percent change. So I'm just wondering, I mean, so given that there's going to be an increase in fine sediment runoff from where these treatment areas, when do we know whether the 12% reduction is going to be achieved from Forest Service land, from the campgrounds, the other measures that you mentioned?
Okay, kind of a long question, so let me try to piece this out a little bit. Let me make this clear. The Lake Tahoe TMDL specifies a 12% reduction from the forest source. That's everything in the forest. It does not specify 12% from the Forest Service lands. Okay. So, when will we know? That's what you're... When will we know? We are monitoring the lake. The lake response is part of the Lake Tahoe TMDL every year. And we have asked the Forest Service to start tracking and monitoring. And you heard from Sue Norman. They're working on this, going to engage all the other forest agency partners to work on all their projects collectively on a basin-wide scale. So as far as exactly when that 12%, we'll never know exactly.
Well, I just want to know that we're driving down the right road. You know?
Well, it's clear to Water Board staff that without BMPs, without the proper BMPs, the advanced BMPs, the SEZ restoration and mitigation requirements, that there will be sediment increases, fine sediment particles. So with those, we feel very comfortable and confident that it will reduce those to less than significant, and we will be able to achieve those load reductions. There's a big effort under the pollutant reduction opportunity analysis as part of the Lake Tahoe TMDL. We had all the experts in the room talking about how to figure out how to achieve these load reductions. We went through a lot of work on that. And that was all peer reviewed, as you know.
Thank you. Okay. Is there anything further on this item 3?
This concludes item 3. So, thank you.
Well, we'll move on then to item 4. United States Forest Service, Lake Tahoe Basin Management Unit, mitigated negative declaration environmental document and proposed waste discharge requirements for the South Shore Fuel Reduction and Healthy Forest Restoration Project. Other other topics.
I'm going to ask George Sella to make the presentation on this item.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, my name is George Sella. I'm an engineering geologist with the Tahontan for 1999. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to discuss this project today. Staff recommends that the Water Board certify the mitigated negative declaration and adopt the waste discharge requirement for the U.S. Forest Service Lake Tahoe Basin Management Units South Shore Fuel Reduction and Healthy Forest Restoration Project. Forest Service proposes to conduct this project on its lands within the boundary outlined in black in this slide and is shown on the wall map over here. Primary management objective is reducing hazard fuels within the South Shore of Lake Tahoe Basin wildland-urban interface. Secondary objectives include providing healthy wildlife habitat, restoring a forest structure with increased resistance to drought, disease, and insects, and restoring aspen stands within South Shore project area. This project will apply a variety of vegetation management treatments on up to 10,200 acres over approximately 5 to 10 years. The major public concern in Lake Tahoe Basin is the threat of catastrophic fire. The cessation of Native American burning practices, followed by secondary growth after the Comstock era logging, in addition to over 60 years of fire suppression in the basin, have resulted in a dense and healthy forest susceptible to severe wildfires. In short, nobody wants to repeat the 2007 Angora fire. The Forest Service is proposing to reduce this wildfire risk. Removing surface and ladder fuels in the wildland-urban interface would provide space for an oncoming crown fire to drop to a surface fire, where deployment of hand crews could be expected to succeed in controlling the spread of the fire. Equally important is thinning of trees to achieve forest health and density more resistant to drought, insects, and disease, along with addressing conifer encroachment in riparian areas, aspen groves, and meadows. A combination of the following methods will be used to meet the fuels and vegetation objectives for the project area. In whole tree logging, felled trees are dragged from the butt end to the landing for sorting, processing, and removal. This treatment requires a road or skid trail network and has the greatest potential to cause disturbance. Landings for this prescription are large enough for log decks, residual slash processing equipment, and log truck and or chip van operations. Residual biomass from whole tree logging is either burned in very large piles or chipped and removed. This is an example of a chipping operation at the landing. Chipper uses an articulated arm to feed the material from the landing piles into the shredder. Look on the slide, you'll see that the articulated arm is holding the tree horizontal, put into the hopper, fed into the chip pan. Landings and roads must be enlarged and widened to accommodate larger than normal turning radius of the chip pan. Cut length equipment is lighter weight machinery traveling on tracks or balloon tires, which uses a mechanical arm to grasp, grab and cut the trees and remove the limbs. Limb material is dropped in place and provides a surface upon which the equipment operates, further lessening ground disturbance related to equipment impacts. Tree bowls are then cut to a specified length and placed in the pile. A forwarder, separate piece of equipment, which is also low ground pressure, picks up the stacked trees, which are then taken to the landing for processing and sorting. Or removal, sorry. This treatment increases ground cover, reduces soil compaction during the removal process, and lessens the number of equipment trips to remove the tree bowls to a landing location. It does not require skid trails and can be done on up to 30% slopes. When thinning with hand crews, trees and limbs are felled and sectioned by handheld chainsaws, usually generating pieces less than 10 feet long that can be handled by one or two people. Typically, the material remains very close to where it falls, and is then piled and allowed to cure for a couple of years prior to being burned in place. For the slide, you'll notice that these are the hand piles here. You can turn your attention to the maps on the wall. This one's very busy, and actually, if you want to know more detail about it, I recommend you look at it after the discussion, after the meeting. If you have any questions, I would direct you to talk to the Forest Service about it. But basically, what it shows is that numerous different kind of operations are occurring in various places over several years. And again, you really have to look at it close to get that idea, but it does have a lot of information on it. The one in the middle shows the type of equipment that is used in the various units. The green units are hand crew units. The orange units cut the length, and the pink units are whole tree logging. As stated previously, the project will apply vegetative treatments to reduce hazard fuels in up to 10,200 acres within the South Shore Wildland-Urban Interface over approximately 5 to 7 years, plus additional time for the pile curing prior to burning. Forest thinning would occur on approximately 2,660 acres per year and would be phased across sub-watersheds to reduce impact on water quality or wildlife. And again, that would be the first map. Of this, no more than 1,350 acres would be mechanically thinned per year. It is anticipated the results of this project will be effective, that is, meet the Forest Service objectives and desired conditions for a period of 15 to 20 years post-treatment. So, why are we involved? California Water Code and the Federal Clean Water Act provide the Water Board's authority to regulate discharges of sediment to surface water and to take steps to ensure water quality protection. US EPA and the state of California have designated Lake Tahoe as an outstanding national resource water, or ONRW, which affords Lake Tahoe the highest level of protection. Lake Tahoe Basin is unique in the nation with special protection for Stream Environment Zones, or SEZs. Lake transparency is currently hampered by the discharge of fine sediment, and this project proposes many soil disturbing activities. The question has arisen, why the waste discharge requirements instead of the timber waiver? The waste discharge requirement provides regulatory consistency and certainty for the life of the South Shore project, unlike the timber waiver, which will expire in 2014. Turn your attention to the slide. You'll see that the waste discharge requirement provides single regulatory action, one single grading variance for all the winter operations that will occur throughout the life of the project, a one-time stream environment zone prohibition exemption. WDR also allows greater flexibility and ensures the stream environment zone restoration and road rehabilitation. We received 4 comment letters on the tentative waste discharge requirements in February of this year, and 3 additional comment letters during the public comment period of the proposed waste discharge requirement, which ended April 2nd. Overall, all of the comment letters expressed an overwhelming support for this project, and that the project be done in the most efficient and responsible way. We concur. The Water Board followed the Governor's May 27, 2008 proclamation, which strongly encouraged the Water Board to take expeditious action to implement the recommendations of the Fire Commission report. Those findings have been considered during the development of the permit. Some of the Fire Commission report findings listed in the comment letters are not appropriate for the permit because the Water Board does not have specific authorities related to them. At this point, I'd like to bring my division manager.
Okay, George, thank you. Doug Smith, supervising geologist. I do not have a slide on this, but what I wanted to do, and you all have this, and there's copies on the back, and I wanted to enter it into the record. This is an excerpt of from the Fire Commission report of finding 12. This was a common theme, which finding 12 basically says that there's just a lot of permitting requirements and additional layers, and then there's recommendations, okay? Recommendations to streamline and do all sorts of things. So what I did on the back of this is I also excerpted the May 27, 2008 Governor's Proclamation, the part that actually pertained to the Water Board. And it says strongly encourage the Water Board to do these things, to do the recommendations. And so I listed out some of the things that the Water Board has done since then. Immediately, in 2008, the Water Board entered into an MOU with TRPA covering vegetation-related activities. And under that MOU said, the MOU said that TRPA would be the sole permanent agency. Well, as you learned later, or probably, I don't know how many months ago it was, but that was thrown out of court, so we had to take it back over. Okay, so we're doing the permitting. Also, right after that, in 2009, the Water Board adopted the 2009 timber waiver, a region-wide timber waiver, that facilitates low-threat fuel reduction projects. Those are defensible space projects and urban lands, fire district lands, fuel reduction. No fees on that, and no Water Board review on those, except for Category 6. And allows equipment and pile burning in SEZ. So there's a lot of things that the Water Board has done and staff has done. And I just wanted to have that for the record. And with that, I'll turn it back over to George and he can continue on this. Oh, yeah, that's right. Thank you. I forgot. There is a slide I'm doing. And here it comes up. We did receive comments that from US EPA that the waste discharge requirement should require modeling to meet TMDL requirements. We responded to this, and those responses are in the packet. I don't have the exact page on that. But basically what we said is that the TMDL doesn't specify, it does not require projects to meet a load reduction requirement. As I mentioned before in my presentation, that the forest source has to meet the 12% load reduction requirement, not individual projects. So collectively, from all the activities, all the ski run, enhancement projects, the campground, BMP retrofits, the legacy sites, restoration, trail and road decommissioning, all of those basin-wide collectively add up to the 12%, not just one project. And so we didn't think it was appropriate to put project-level modeling requirement into a permit, a project-level permit. It should be done more collectively on a basin-wide effort. And as you heard from Sue Norman, they are proceeding down that path, engaging all the other forest agencies in the basin to figure out the best way, and they're engaging us in that. There is no need for us to put in that requirement in here. And so, now, back to George.
We would disagree with that the permit would cause project delays. In fact, quite the opposite. Water Board and Forest Service staff have worked together to craft a permit that enables Forest Service to meet its project goals while protecting water quality. This included streamlining processes and retaining essential steps where the Water Board and staff input is needed. Plus, Water Board staff is committed to expeditiously responding to field review requests. This means that most, if not all, such requests will be conducted within approximately 48 to 72 hours. Forest Service may develop and submit unit-specific work plans on an annual basis while continuing to conduct other project elements. Reviews of annual operating plans may take a couple weeks, but in no case will exceed 30 days. Water Board staff is committed to timely reviews to the Forest Service, so the Forest Service is able to meet its goals and protect water quality. As stated previously, no additional stream environment zone prohibition exemptions or grading season variances are needed, which further streamlines and removes potential project delays. During cooperative meetings with the Forest Service and the TRPA, Forest Service resource protection measures were augmented to ensure that agency staff, operators, and the public all understand exactly what the Forest Service will do in any given situation. Added best management practices are necessary so that we can make the finding that sediment loads are not increased due to the project. The visual monitoring requirements are designed to ensure that the project best management practices are installed and functioning properly, that the measures were effective in controlling sediment discharge sources, and that any new sediment sources occurring as a result of the project are tracked down and corrected. The reporting requirements specify that monitoring reports be submitted twice a year. Bioassessment monitoring is also required, but only on Saxon Creek. A full description of this monitoring site may be found at the bottom of base number 4-151 in your agenda packet, which is permit attachment G, rationale for bioassessment monitoring. And if I may again draw your attention to the map over here, this orange square is the approximate location of the Saxon Creek site. The Saxon Creek site was specifically selected as it is downgradient of units proposed for whole tree harvesting. Areas of road crossing, roads and crossing construction and reconstruction, and areas of stream environment zone pile burning. Bioassessment monitoring provides an opportunity for the Forest Service to verify that the techniques employed will protect or enhance aquatic habitat in the area where these higher threat to water quality activities are to occur. Minor edits were made to address concerns raised during public review periods for both the tentative and the proposed waste discharge requirements. Late revisions were also made in cooperation with Forest Service staff to make the permit best management practices more understandable to all parties while addressing Forest Service needs and our concerns. Please allow me to repeat what I said at the beginning of this talk. Staff recommends that the Water Board certify the mitigated negative declaration and adopt the waste discharge requirement for the South Shore Fuel Reduction and Healthy Forest Restoration Project. The project itself is a necessity And the Forest Service, TRPA, and the Hunt and staff have worked hard together to produce a workable project which accomplishes the Forest Service goals and the community needs while protecting water quality in a clear and obvious manner. Thank you.
Any questions? Dr. Horn? Mr. Tompkins?
How to do that? Great secret.
Check this out.
We have a number of folks that wish to speak on this topic. And I have four cards here. And the first being Nancy Gibson, Board Supervisor.
I would request that Barry Hill from our regional office speak. He'll have a few minutes, and then I'd like to follow him, please.
Yes, Barry Hill, U.S. Forest Service.
Well, good evening, Chairman Jardine, board members. Thank you for this opportunity to provide remarks on the proposed waste discharge requirements for the South Shore Fields Project on behalf of the Forest Service Regional Office and Regional Forester Andrew Moore. You've heard mention already of the Emergency California-Nevada Tahoe Basin Fire Commission report that was published in 2008. I'd just like to enumerate a few of the many conclusions of that report. First, that the water quality and clarity of Lake Tahoe depend on protection from catastrophic wildfires. I don't think that's been mentioned so far this evening. The risk of wildfires in the Lake Tahoe Basin is extremely high and increasing, and this risk presents an imminent threat to life, property, and the environment. Fuels reduction treatments implemented on national forest lands prior to the Angora fire worked as designed to reduce fire intensity. And the erosion control methods used for those projects were effective in preventing significant impacts to water quality. The regulatory policies of this board at that time were found to have delayed projects and increased costs. And further, there was a recommendation in this report that I'd like to read in part. Regulatory restrictions and limitations should be modified or waived to allow the use of mechanized equipment within SEZs for effective, efficient, and economical removal of fuels. Restrictions regarding the use of mechanized equipment in such areas should be greatly and substantially reduced to make such cleaning and clearing activities within SEZs feasible over the time period reasonably necessary to complete the community wildfire protection projects within the Lake Tahoe Basin. And another recommendation was that fuels treatment projects by the Forest Service should be encouraged and supported, including more intensive treatments on steeper slopes. And also, as has been mentioned, this board, in response to this report, developed a waiver of waste discharge requirements, commonly referred to as the timber waiver, as adopted by this board in 2009. The waiver recognized the need to address the current and growing threat of catastrophic wildfire. The Lake Tahoe Basin Management Unit and the Regional Office of the Forest Service worked extensively with your staff to develop this waiver, and we supported its adoption, anticipating that the new waiver would expedite fuels treatments needed to protect communities and water quality in the Lake Tahoe Basin. Former Lahontan Board Member James Charlton remarked on the collaborative nature of the waiver development in a letter dated May 15, 2009, to, at that time, Forest Supervisor Terry Marceron. I'd like to read just some short excerpts from that letter. I have served on a number of public boards over the years. I have never before been privileged to see the members of two organizations with overlapping authority and differing mandates work so hard, so professionally, and so thoughtfully together to hammer out a compromise that both sides were comfortable enough with. I am speaking about the waiver of waste discharge requirements for timber harvest and vegetation management activities in the Lahontan region that we adopted. In fact, the level of working professionalism and respect for each other was so obvious, I am hard-pressed to even suggest there were two sides. everyone by their actions made it manifest that serving the public's best interest was the mandate to which they were all responding. That's the end of the quote from Mr. Charlton's letter. I've read through the proposed conditions of the waste discharge requirement, and it's difficult for me to conclude that they are anything other than largely inconsistent with the findings and recommendations of the Fire Commission report. They appear likely to delay and increase costs for urgently needed fuels reduction projects that are known to be effective in reducing fire spread and that have minimal potential for adverse effects to water quality. Given the level of effort and the collaboration that went into the development of the waiver by your staff, the Forest Service, and others, the waiver deserves careful consideration as an approach for regulating the South Shore project. And I'll close by reading a short quote from the website of the Sierra Forest Legacy. The Angora fire at South Lake Tahoe is still fresh in the hearts and minds of the residents of the communities impacted by this devastating event. We believe that the hope of preventing such a disastrous loss of property in the future lies in advancing a fuels reduction program and community protection measures which are based on science, not ill-conceived political considerations. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? We have a question. Dr. Horn.
Thank you. I'm wondering whether you can accomplish the project goals with this permit.
I'd like to defer to Nancy Gibson on that question, if I may.
Thank you. Nancy Gibson, Board Supervisor.
Good evening, Chairman Jardine and members of the board. I'm Nancy Gibson, Forest Supervisor for the Lake Tahoe Basin Management Unit, and I'm pleased to be presenting to you in support of the South Shore Fuel Reduction and Healthy Forest Restoration Project. This opportunity comes as I reflect back on my first year here on the Lake Tahoe Basin Management Unit, which was Monday. So, on the resources side of the house, a lot of great effort has gone into working closely with Lahontan staff in permit preparation for a number of projects, including Blackwood and High Meadows. These are sizable projects, and through them, I have met and worked with a number of your staff, including George Sella. Where'd he go? There he is. Doug Cushman, Doug Smith, and of course, Lori Kemper and Harold Singer. I want to continue to work closely with these folks in moving forward on the important work we do on behalf of Lake Tahoe and the public we serve. I'm here tonight to ask you to approve the waste discharge requirement permit for the project with modifications. With that in mind, I'd also like to share with you some of the history of this project with the hope that we can find some lessons for the future. I'm sure you're aware of the history of the Lake Tahoe Basin Management Unit and the fact that water quality is central to our mission. At the same time, we have a responsibility to evaluate the effects of our actions to all resources for which we manage. Balancing all our management actions is embedded in our Forest Service mission to sustain the health, diversity, and productivity of the nation's forests and grasslands to meet the needs of present and future generations. We know that within the intricacies of the natural world, improving the balance of vegetation and hydrologic systems will ultimately ensure the highest possible water quality and improve sustainable habitat for plants and animals. We have successfully implemented a number of projects that achieve these goals while also reducing the risk of wildfire to many communities surrounding Lake Tahoe. These examples can be seen in the Slaughterhouse Canyon, Round Hill, and Spooner projects on the Nevada side, and the Ward, Quail, and Cathedral projects on the California side. Monitoring reports indicate successful implementation of these projects, including work within stream environment zones that we've completed in Nevada. Our long-term goal is to ensure we have a programmatic way in which we can continue fuels reduction projects that protect all the communities of the Lake Tahoe Basin. So what fuels work have we done lately? In the projects mentioned above, we have a proven track record of successfully implementing fuels reduction projects while protecting water quality. Over the last decade, the LTBMU has completed more than 20,000 acres of vegetation treatments and fuels reductions on the California and Nevada sides of the lake. These include typical forestry practices such as hand and mechanical thinning, prescribed burning, temporary road construction for access, landings, and road maintenance. Fuels projects on the Nevada side move through the approval process much more quickly. We have completed planning, analysis, project implementation, and monitoring for fuel reduction treatments on 5,000 acres in Nevada in the time it has taken us to simply complete planning for South Shore. Planning for another 4,000 acres near Incline Village, Nevada, is nearly complete. Our monitoring has demonstrated the effectiveness of our best management practices. Additionally, Lahontan staff have accepted our BMP evaluation program as a way to monitor water quality impacts. We have even adapted this program to meet their needs at specific sites. Our goal with this and every project is to apply our BMPs consistently and effectively and to promptly practice adaptive management to address any concerns. The South Shore project involves more acreage in one project, but the treatments, techniques, and resource protection measures are substantially the same. Because it aims to protect Lake Tahoe's largest community, the South Shore project includes more treatment acres than past projects. We chose to analyze more than 70,000 acres in the interest of efficient and comprehensive analysis. More acreage does not, in itself, create a significant impact. While my record of decision approves treatment on more than 10,000 acres, implementation will occur over 10 years. Due to our limited field season and the few contractors interested in working in the Lake Tahoe Basin, the number of acres we will treat per year is comparable to our smaller projects. We recognize that the South Shore project charts new territory for Lahontan because it includes treatments in SEZs using hand and mechanical treatments as well as prescribed fire. While SEZ treatments using mechanical equipment are new for Lahontan, the Forest Service has successfully implemented them in the Round Hill and Spooner projects on the Nevada side and at the Heavenly Valley SEZ demonstration project on the California side. SEZ treatments are critical. While SEZ treatments using mechanical equipment are new for the Lahontan, we've done it for a long time, especially in the Round Hill and Spinner projects on the Nevada side and Heavenly Valley SEZ demonstration project on the California side. SEZ treatments are critical. Without treatment, certain SEZs overloaded with surface fuels and dense conifers serve as a wick to carry high-severity fire, as was shown in the 2007 Angora fire. Restrictions have made treating SEZs theoretically possible, but in practice, prohibitively expensive and time-consuming. So our recent history with the fire and South Shore project, we are approaching the fifth anniversary of the Angora fire, which occurred on June 24, 2007. The fire was devastating to our community, destroying 254 homes and temporarily displacing countless residents and visitors. Completed fuels treatments that occurred in the area prior to the blaze were proven effective, and the forest maintains healthy and intact in many of these areas. This event confirmed the need to treat SEZs as the Angora fire traveled swiftly through the untreated Angora Creek SEZ and into the community. It's appropriate to take a look back at the history of the South Shore project, and in particular, the call for action embodied in the Bi-State Fire Commission report dated May 2008. The LTBMU has been working on the South Shore analysis beginning in 2004 and had moved into stakeholder meetings prior to the Angora fire, including meetings with Lahontan staff. Based on initial discussions with Lahontan and in the spirit of needing to streamline the approval process for fuels reduction projects identified by the Bi-State Fire Commission, the two agencies decided to proceed via a joint NEPA CEQA document. From 2007 until 2009, both agencies worked to complete a draft EIS, draft EIR, on the South Shore proposed action. With the inclusion of Alternative 3, Lahontan Executive Director Harold Singer indicated to Forest Supervisor Terry Marceron in March 2008 that the draft EIS would meet CEQA requirements and that work could begin soon after completion of the final document. Alternative 3 was developed to respond to water quality and wildlife concerns brought forward from the public. In 2009, after 2 years of extensive coordination, Lahontan and the Forest Service released the joint draft EIS, draft EIR. However, after further discussions, Forest Service and Lahontan staff came to an impasse regarding the significance of the project. Lahontan staff requested additional analysis and mitigations for completion of the final environmental impact statement, despite our analysis concluding that the project had less than significant impact. In May 2009, soon after the release of the draft EIS EIR, Lahontan finalized the new timber waiver. In winter 2010, the Forest Service decided to proceed with completion of its environmental document separately due to disagreement on the significance of impacts and the added details and analysis required by Lahontan staff. We believe the discussion was delaying the project without changing the outcome of the proposed action. The LTBMU continued working to address Lahontan's concerns, address public comments, and incorporate current resource survey information into our final EIS. We were proceeding with these updates to the final EIS to provide clear information that would allow us to enroll the project under the timber waiver. However, in April 2010, before we released our final EIS, Lahontan staff released the tentative WDR with rewrites of our BMPs, stating that the WDR would satisfy the CEQA requirements. In September 2011, we released our final EIS, which incorporated many of Lahontan's concerns and requirements. In October 2011, we once more discussed with Lahontan staff our determination that the final EIS did not identify significant impact. The Forest Service requested use of the timber waiver, which allows for the more streamlined permitting called for by the Fire Commission. Lahontan staff told us that the timber waiver was not appropriate and offered us the options of the WDR process or proceeding with a full EIR. We were told the EIR would take 2 years to complete and that they would charge the cost of this report to the Forest Service. Pragmatically, to embark on yet another environmental analysis, even as our current comprehensive EIS has been well over $1 million in the making, simply made no sense. So I have a chart here that says WDR versus timber waiver. So the Forest Service continues to believe the timber waiver would have been the appropriate tool for permitting the South Shore project. The timber waiver was designed for the types of activities we will be implementing along the South Shore. The timber waiver allows for streamlining in project permitting and implementation called for by the Fire Commission. We believe the timber waiver for this project could have been completed soon after I signed the record of decision in January 2012. But now we're in the process we're in now. We have all learned a great deal about the different perspectives of Forest Service and Lahontan field staff, and in that respect have been working together very closely, putting in countless hours during this home stretch. I especially appreciate the hard work of Doug Smith from Lahontan and Duncan Leo from the Forest Service. Both were facing the WDR process as a workable challenge given what option was put in front of us. It is also clear to all of us that we must move forward with this project this summer. So I want to talk about meaningful dialogue and streamlining and trust. The impasse that occurred in 2009 is unfortunate. However, I'm less interested in looking backward when we, as both state and federal agencies, have a responsibility to instill public trust. The public expects and deserves that we work out our differences respectfully and with minimum setback to the important work that is needed in the basin. We must also be mindful of the effectiveness of the actions we pursue in terms of protections and costs. The Fire Commission was clear in pointing out needed protections to the lake while addressing the current and growing threat of catastrophic wildfire. We also have two very different roles, and we need to be clear, both to ourselves and to the public, on when and where we wield our field skills and expertise. To summarize our roles and responsibilities for the complete analysis, decision, and implementation of the South Shore Project, please be clear. For the Forest Service, the analysis area of 73,000 acres over a nearly 8-year period
yielded a 10,000-acre project that meets all the requirements of multiple natural resources laws and regulations. In complying with the National Environmental Policy Act, this project analysis and range of alternatives was actively vetted by the public, with many of these comments, including those of Lahontan staff, incorporated into the final EIS. Because we are responsible for a broad range of interdisciplinary analyses, this goes well beyond water alone and takes in the big picture, including effects to communities, along with other plant and animal species. By putting to bear our full expertise as a natural resources land management agency, I determined that the final EIS analysis substantiates that the project achieves its goals of fuels reduction and healthy forest restoration with no adverse impacts to the environment. The final EIS contains, in Chapter 4, monitoring requirements for soil, water, and riparian resources, aquatic resources, transportation, sensitive plants, and invasive weeds. These monitoring BMPs are contained in Appendix B. As stated earlier, these are actively used and thoroughly evaluated for compliance with all national and regional standards. For the Lahontan Water Board, the primary responsibility of the Water Board is to protect the quality of the surface and groundwater within the region for beneficial uses, as stated in this evening's meeting package. State agencies are permitted to use federal NEPA analyses to meet CEQA requirements, saving time and money. We believe our EIS met all the mitigation requirements of CEQA and no further analysis was necessary. After opting for the WDR permitting process, Lahontan staff brought forward 85 points of issues regarding the resource protection measures and rewrote them as BMPs, which are included in Attachment F of the WDR. Staff in both agencies have worked tirelessly from early October 2011 to the present. We have agreed to these added requirements in order to move the project forward. We believe they are unnecessary and redundant. We stand by our EIS and its resource protection measures, monitoring, and adaptive management practices. In addition to all the reworked language embedded in the WDR, the supplemental material provided by your staff on April 4th refines some of what have been very time-consuming dialogue. Some of the requirements Lahontan staff brought forward are fairly benign. Other requirements add cost to the project, cause implementation delays, or second-guess the expertise of our professionals in the field. For example, the buffers Lahontan staff are requiring in the WDR for areas outside an SEZ or other water body are excessive and decrease the number of acres we can treat. The requirement for bioassessment monitoring is unnecessary given our overall monitoring requirements and is overreaching for the purpose and need of this project. It is also an additional cost that will simply have to be offset by fewer acres treated in removing hazardous fuels. It is also redundant given a long-term assessment already underway by the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency. Regulating forestry and prescribed fire practices where they have no effect on water quality. For instance, BMPs related to the application of borax, a fungicide, to cut stumps, and approving fire management prescriptions, respectively. The latter was eventually dropped. I don't believe it would be in the board's best interest to assume responsibility and liability by requiring that it approve Forest Service burn plans without having met all the requirements, certifications, etc., necessary for this critical task. Transportation safety on public roads within the project area. We believe many of these requirements venture beyond the scope of the Water Board's responsibility. So tonight, this is my request and the hope I have for looking forward to the future. Funding for the planning and much of the implementation of the South Shore project has been provided through Southern Nevada Public Land Management Act funds. The Lake Tahoe Basin has been fortunate to have a reliable source of funds for fuels reduction and ecosystem restoration projects. Right now, we anticipate that funding will be less consistent and more difficult to obtain for the foreseeable future. Spending funds on planning, unnecessary restrictions, and wordsmithing BMPs that have proven their efficacy reduces the number of acres we can treat. We ask that the Lahontan Regional Water Quality Control Board help us maximize the effectiveness of our project funds in the future and get fuels treatments and restoration projects on the ground more quickly. We ask that we all continue to strive toward the Fire Commission's goal of streamlining the permitting process to help meet our dual goals of protecting Lake Tahoe communities from wildfire and restoring the health of our forests. Let's use the effective tools already available to us, such as the timber waiver, rather than shortchanging that effort. What is the utility of the timber waiver if it is not appropriate for projects such as South Shore? Respect and trust that we are committed to the protection of water quality and have in place adequate and proven BMPs to make this happen. I ask that you use your authority to remove the bioassessment monitoring that was an unnecessary add-on to this project as recently as this past January. Again, we believe it adds no value to the project and is redundant with other monitoring. It will add cost to the project, reducing the number of acres we can treat. I also ask that you direct Lahontan executives to stay focused on their mission of protecting water quality and actively embrace streamlining opportunities, such as that provided by the 2009 timber waiver. Above all, I ask that you approve the negative declaration in WDR tonight so we can begin implementing the South Shore project this summer. This has been an inordinately long process, and we can serve our communities much better in both timeliness and with integrity by mutually achieving critical protections for our communities and our environment by the most expedient means. Thank you for your time, and my project lead, Duncan Leo, is in attendance tonight, and we're happy to answer any questions you have.
Dr. Moore.
Can you accomplish your project goals with this permit?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Crawford.
Earlier, our staff provided a presentation that included a slide titled WDR versus Timber Waiver.
Mm-hmm.
And it itemized four elements to support the fact that the WDR is more appropriate than the timber waiver. Did you wish to address those items?
Well, in my rapid pace trying to understand everything about Lahontan there is to understand in the last few months, there are a couple of departures in what I think is the most expedient way to have approached South Shore. The hitch seemed to be over the description of significance, and for that reason, things tended to shift away from the timber waiver to the use of the WDR and the CEQA process. But the reality is it's the same application of fuel reduction that has been successful, that the monitoring BMPs have been in place, and that has proven itself to be effective, and the timber waiver would have been a more expedient way to accomplish that. Now, what we're doing in, with the WDR is we're paying fees that we would not have to pay under the waiver, an annual fee of $2,000-some plus a Cal Fish and Game fee for the CEQA piece of it that we would not normally have had to pay under the waiver. We also, we're projecting that accomplishing all that is contained in the project, 10,000 acres over about a 10-year period, that the timber waiver expires in 5 years. But the reality is you can also address the timber waiver in elements of units that don't require the Category 6 levels of analysis, and that you can re-up the timber waiver at year 5 if that's what needs to happen. So the departure between the two, I'm not sure is that great, other than what it has taken to rework our BMPs into language suitable for Lahontan under the WDRs, and some of that rework has seemed not necessary to me. As a matter of fact, in the supplement, I was just looking over these quickly, and again, I'm trying to stay focused on what is the role of Lahontan in terms of stream courses and water bodies. And there's a statement here about based on consultation with the discharger's federal forestry professional and recreation officer, the forest supervisors shall authorize plans for temporary closures and activities from the project to ensure the safest condition for the discharger's workers and the general public. I wasn't sure that was a Lahontan role. I mean, I have responsibility for public safety in all of the national forest lands, and if it comes to a point of road closures, I work through my Office of General Counsel because they take a dim view on closing the public out of public lands. So I'm wondering at what point I just have you call OGC to make this happen. You know, that kind of thing is a little... I can't see the nexus there in what the role of the Water Quality Board is. The one on boraxing cut stumps is another one. You know, when you cut a tree and you don't want fungus to take over and create other havoc in the woods, you put a fungicide on them. And that cut tree stump, I could see if it said anywhere within the SEZ, but that has been placed on there for the entire project. So I don't understand how that works. And there are a number of them like that that took a lot of hand-wringing over. The burn plan is one of the ones more significantly that we really were pretty adamant about why in the world would you want to put yourself in the position of approving Forest Service burn plans. So those kinds of things seemed unnecessary to me. And again, I'm coming into it with a little bit of a novice view because I only really started getting involved in this particular project in October. But again, those are the kinds of things we spent months and months and months working through, and really graciously, I will say that people have been gracious in working through them, but the adamant necessity to have these things incorporated in the WDRs when I have Appendix B in my EIS that really started out as an EA, from our perspective, there never was significance. But in the dialogue, because the acres seem to be of concern, we went to an EIS that has taken, you know, from 2004 to today to get finalized. And so now we really want to implement the project.
One more question, please, and I apologize, but in your concluding remarks, you made a recommendation for our board tonight. Could you please repeat that?
The recommendation is to drop the bioassessment. That was another place, it was a point of departure, I guess I would say, because this project has been well along the way. It's been mapped out from 2004. We were on the home stretch. I signed the record of decision on January 12th. And then at the 11th hour, it was, well, let's put this bioassessment in.
So that was that one spot over there on Saxon Creek that
correct.
George Sella pointed out.
Yeah, and I have a map here showing all the other points of monitoring that already occur from our agency as well as TRPA. And adding one more at that stage of the game, I just did not see where it was relevant to tie this project up for yet another level of monitoring and analysis.
Thank you.
Can I ask just one question on that bioassessment monitoring?
Yes.
You mentioned that you thought that duplicated the long-term assessment being performed by TRPA.
I understand that TRPA, since 2009, has been doing some point monitoring, stream-based point monitoring, and this map depicts some of what that's.
What type of monitoring is that they're doing?
I don't know specifically, and there's... Okay, maybe Duncan can help.
So thanks for having me up here. Nancy mentioned bioassessment monitoring being conducted by TRPA since 2009. We have a map here that shows the recommended South Shore Saxon site for the permit, as well as, I believe, 16 other sites, including reference sites and sites that alternate every other year within the South Shore project area. In and adjacent to treatment units within the project, as I understand, the intent of bioassessment monitoring is to establish a long-term trend, and in order to get a baseline, you need to start monitoring these sites years before you're actually doing anything. And then, hence, since 2009, they've established reference sites and alternating sites within the South Shore Project area that they, I believe, intend to continue to monitor.
So the monitoring is taking place as we speak now?
Yes. And Sue, or even TRPA, would like to... I don't want to put you on the spot.
No, it's not ELTA. It's a program that Shane Romsos over at TRPA is managing, and it's a bioassessment monitoring program throughout the entire basin that he's embedded in the threshold monitoring program for TRPA. And I talked to him about his coverage in South Shore, and it's what Duncan said, there's a variety of sites. Some of them are getting monitored every year, some of them are getting monitored every other year. But, you know, when I discussed what we were doing with the South Shore Project and what was happening at Saxon, he felt like the monitoring they already had in place would answer the question. We would be able to tie impacts, you know, the data they collected from bioassessment to what activities we were doing upstream of those sites. And there was quite a few of them throughout the South Shore Project.
And I guess then the question would be is, do you know if TRPS funding for that monitoring
through the
life of your project and beyond?
Yeah, I asked Shane that specifically because that was one of my concerns, and he felt very strongly that they were going to have the funding to do that. That was one of what he felt was one of the more critical monitoring components of their threshold monitoring program. So he couldn't, of course, say absolutely, but when I asked him, you know, what's your feeling on that? And he felt quite confident that it was going to be funded.
If the board decided to withdraw that one sample site and we continued with the TRPA monitoring, would the Forest Service be willing to commit to funding that if the TRPA funding fell off the table so we would have that over the long term?
I guess my question is, how many more things do we put in this limited $2 million pot before we're not treating acres? Because, you know, this wasn't part of how this 8 years of analysis was progressing. It was something that we were asked to first consider in January, and then it was no longer a consideration. It just showed up.
But you didn't answer this question.
Can I commit today to additional monitoring post-TRPA? I don't see how I could commit today unless I figure out what else isn't going to get done. I mean, I guess the point that I'm trying to impress upon folks is we've been living pretty high on SNPLMA dollars, and when that goes away, we're going to have to be very much more discreet in how we get projects implemented on the ground. And with fuel reduction, that isn't something that I would personally want to defer for some other purpose at this time.
Yes. On a different question, you commented during your presentation that because of the restrictions being imposed, you were not going to be able to treat certain buffer areas, and that because of the monitoring, you would not be able to put those dollars onto the ground to do fuel reduction. That's what I thought I heard you say.
The upshot is where it's essential to monitor and provide buffers within stream environment zones, that makes all the sense in the world. Mm-hmm. When it goes outside of that zone area, it doesn't make sense to impose something that is not needed, that we have BMPs in place that already sufficiently address.
If I could, let me finish the question, though. You also answered Dr. Horn's question that, given the WDRs the way they were put forward, and maybe with the one modification you've asked for on the bioassessment, that you could accomplish your project goals. And to me, at least, I'm hearing two different things. One, you can accomplish your project goals. Secondly, there are things that are going to take dollars away from activities you want to do on the ground. And I'm not sure if those two things coincide. They seem to be contradictory.
Well, let me help align it a little bit. We have done analysis on a 10,000 acre project over 10 years. We have implementation funds for a portion of that. So SNPLMA is only going to go so far into the first several, probably up to 5 years. Beyond 5 years, it will be how well have we stated our case for additional budget allocation to make that come together. Working with partners, working, you know, however it goes beyond this 5-year period. But I can't promise that everything for the 10,000 acres is going to happen in the 10 years' time, because the funding stream is, the trajectory on that is about 5 years. So we just, as I think it was your presentation earlier, if we're able to treat about 2,600 a year, then we hope to get that into our regular appropriated cycle to be able to have long-term funds, because it's not done. I mean, I think we all recognize that prescribed fuel treatment is not done in 10 years. It will be a regular, recurring, ongoing thing. Things grow up and they die and they create slash. And so we do need to address that for the long term. But this is such a strong leg up on those most critical areas surrounding South Lake Tahoe that this is the priority for the agency.
Again, Ms. Gibson, if I can come back to the one point you made about buffer zones. And I think you indicated that you were not able to treat certain buffer zones because of the restrictions in these proposed waste discharge requirements. So I guess I still want to ask the question is, can you accomplish your fuel reduction goals by not treating those buffer zones that you referred to in your presentation?
I didn't state in the presentation that the buffer zones would create less opportunity. Mostly the bioassessment was the new thing that was going to impact costs. We have worked closely with Lahontan staff to make the most of the language that has gone into the buffer discussions, and we will make those work.
So you will be able to provide the fuel reduction goals that you're trying to achieve with the restrictions that I think you mentioned about work in buffer zones that is in the draft permit?
If the buffer zones had never come into play, we would have more money to treat the acres within the first 5 years that we have this finite pot of money for SNPLMA. But the analysis for 10,000 acres will be what our priority is for any out-year budget requests beyond the SNPLMA funds.
Yes, Mr. Pumphrey.
Do you have a sense of what the increase in acreage would be if the bioassessment monitoring section was removed?
Let me see. Duncan, do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, if I may answer that. We estimated the cost of staff time to do the monitoring, the fees to send off the samples, as well as the administrative oversight of that. And we're estimating approximately $25,000 to $30,000 over the life of the project. That would
life of the project being 10 years?
Approximately 10 years. As I interpret the WDR permit, as soon as our units are complete in that adjacent stream or watershed, then monitoring would occur shortly after to finish off that area. So it could be about 10 years. That's equivalent to probably 30 to 40 acres of treatments that we could be doing next to homes and or sensitive areas.
And would this be 30 to 40 acres of treatment in addition to the project acres that are already incorporated? So would these be new acres?
So here's your trade-off. The dollar amount it would take for the monitoring would take away from the fixed amount of money that we have now that poor Supervisor Gibson was alluding to. So to answer your question, that would be how we need to creatively figure out which treatments and how, with cost in mind, these treatments are not inexpensive. And if anything, we've seen over the last 5 years treatment costs increasing both from the hand and mechanical side of things, as well as the prescriber and
what I don't understand, if we're talking about these 30 to 40 acres, is that 30 to 40 acres that will not be treated under the project as proposed, or where do those 30 or 40 acres, where are they? Where do they come from?
The 30 to 40 acres is the equivalent dollar amount.
I understand that
right.
part.
So we have not determined where that falls in to the project area at this point. We have funding secured for the majority of the project currently. So our first few use treatments are funded, and as we are continually seeing costs increase and other constraints with regards to cost, that will probably trickle into the later end of the project unless more funding is provided. Does that help trying to answer your question?
Well, no, it actually it doesn't. the reason it doesn't is the sense I have of what you're saying is that there are 30 or 40 acres that are going to go untreated because they're not part of the project, because they couldn't be included in the project because of the cost of the bioassessment monitoring. So they fall out of the project somehow. I'm trying to get an idea of what it is that reduces the project in size or cause the project to be reduced in size because of this bioassessment monitoring.
I think the challenge is we have an analysis area here that equates to 10,000 acres of treatable acres, and we have limited funding. And they don't marry up precisely, because if we had kicked this project off in 2006, we would have been talking about less inflated dollars then, and therefore the money spreads further. So now we're talking 2012 dollars. You only have so much money, and it only goes so far. When we do analysis, we never do analysis necessarily betting that we have dollars for every acre to treat. We do analysis because that's the ability to evaluate the full scope of the project, and then when the dollars are available to us, we nick away at that project to the best of our ability. So the amount of money, you know, necessarily, if you put too much over here, you don't have enough to do over here. And so, you know, our goal is certainly to aggressively address the fuels in that area. We have the analysis that substantiates our ability to do that. It's all funding dependent. We currently have SNPLMA funds in the bank, but the SNPLMA funds never were to a 10-year, 10,000-acre project. It was only to get started in fuels reduction because that's what we had to work with.
I have a follow-up question for Duncan.
Follow-up question, and I'd like to take a break.
Okay. So when you said 30 to 40 acres, were you assuming whole tree harvesting, or were you assuming half of it would be hand treatment? I mean, it seems
it's
like depending on which method of treatment you're using, it would be a variable amount of acres.
Right, so I believe the very first question was how much does it cost? I was trying to qualify what that could relate to in terms of trade-offs for how that might affect how we treat an area, an acre. So this 30 to 40 acres is based on an average acre cost, which is, you know,
for this project, which includes
for this project. So it's not specifically tied to one specific treatment. It's, you know, a general estimate of an average acre cost.
Okay.
In that case, we'll take a 10-minute break.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And it concluded.
Yeah. Well, that we don't accept
Well, we've received a lot of information over the last hour or so, and I'd like to get a bit of a response from the Lahontan staff.
Well, I'm going to start, and I may need some help. My name is Lori Kemper. I'm the Assistant Executive Officer. First, I'd just like to say that this project obviously has taken a lot longer than we all expected it would. And I think that Water Board staff has been working with the Forest Service staff for a long time, since, I don't know when exactly, on the South Shore project in terms of planning. But back in the time period of 2008 and 2009, we had agreed with the Forest Service that we would pursue a joint EIR-EIS for the South Shore project. Nancy's right, it's a big project, it's 10,000 acres, but we actually looked at the project as an opportunity for the Forest Service to try a number of things that had never been authorized in the past in the Tahoe Basin, to look at using things like whole tree skidding, to look at bringing equipment into stream environment zones that had never been done in the Tahoe Basin. And because of that, we were not sure about whether or not water quality could be adequately protected. Forest Service brought forward a lot of research that they've done nationwide on BMP effectiveness. None of those studies had ever been focused on fine sediment delivery in the Lake Tahoe Basin. So we really didn't have any information to know whether a standard BMP would be adequate to protect water quality. So we knew that, and we wanted to move forward. We wanted to find a way for the Forest Service to get fuel reduction treatments down in the Tahoe Basin. And we felt the best way to do that was to go out to the public with as much disclosure of what we knew and didn't know, and to be clear that we had a high level of uncertainty about a number of activities that had never really been done in the Tahoe Basin. So that has been that's the spirit in which we went forward with the joint EIR-EIS with the Forest Service. We put out a draft EIR-EIS for the public, and as Nancy said, as a result of we got a lot of comments during that first summer of comments, and in response to those comments, the Forest Service modified their treatment units, and I think the South Shore project is proposed today has less impact overall because temporary roads were decreased. They found other ways to get into areas they wanted to treat, but they also reduced their level of treatment in a number of areas to protect wildlife and to protect water quality. So we supported that alternative 3, which is what is before you today, and we encouraged the Forest Service to work with us to revise that joint EIR-EIS, finalize it, and put it on the street. And we had given the Forest Service track changes a number of times, and we've given them language that we wanted, and that at the time, David Koop was our attorney, so he was reviewing that document as well, and there are differences between the National Environmental Policy Act and the California Environmental Quality Act in terms of the level of detail that needs to be described related to mitigation measures. NEPA requires disclosure of impacts, but not necessarily much discussion of how you're going to mitigate those impacts, and CEQA requires that. We needed a full description, not details. We knew we were going to have design details for BMPs, but we needed a more thorough description of how mitigation was going to occur on the ground. We gave the Forest Service that language to include in the final EIR-EIS, and that was back in the in 2009, and the Forest Service made a decision that they did not want to include the CEQA-level details in that document. They told us they would finalize their document on their own and that we could take that document when they finished it and use it for CEQA purposes and add whatever we needed to make it CEQA compliant. We also had to add the climate change emissions. That was brand new at the time of CEQA. We wrote that section. That is in the current EIS, even though it's not required by NEPA. That was towards the end of 2009 when the Forest Service told us they were not going to proceed. The Water Board staff took that same language that we previously shared with the Forest Service and developed a set of tentative waste discharge requirements. We put that permit on the street in April 2010, and we put that out for public comment, and it was another opportunity for us to disclose what it is we were trying to accomplish. We put together what we thought were BMPs that the Forest Service could implement and still carry out their project goals, but we're also looking for the Forest Service feedback so that we would continue to modify that those requirements if necessary to meet the project goals. But we put what we thought was the level of detail we needed to comply with CEQA and the water code. That particular permit, the April 2010 permit, has been on our website. You could find it easily from the homepage since April 2010. That permit had bioassessment monitoring required. It required at six sites, not one site. There were three sites that were identified and three reference sites. That was what the staff was proposing at the time. That was based on Tom Sook, who's our bioassessment expert, his opinion about how much sampling you needed. We wanted a reference site and a site related to particular kinds of disturbance. The Forest Service Zone Environmental Analysis showed there was potential for going over their cumulative watershed effects threshold, so we identified sites. In fact, Taylor Creek, where we were today, was one of those sites we were going to do bioassessment. Another site was the site near the Nez Perce site that we were at today as well, that little stream. In our review of those sites in the last year or so with the Forest Service and with our own staff, we determined that there were other confounding things going on. At Taylor Creek, you've got the dam from Fallen Leaf Lake, too many other things that might interfere with the results in terms of what we were seeing. The beaver, there's a lot of beaver activity there. At this little site that's an unnamed tributary up in Nez Perce near Osgood Swamp, that was another site where there's been a lot of damage from the existing crossing, and we just felt like there wasn't going to be enough value in looking at bioassessment at that spot. So we narrowed our choices to the Saxon Creek location because it is a unique opportunity to evaluate the effects of whole tree skidding and temporary road construction and burn piles and SCZs. There are no other confounding activities upstream of that site. It's also a great site because of the reference conditions that Duncan had mentioned, that yes, TRPA, I think the Forest Service in the past, and possibly our own contractor have sampled Saxon Creek in the past, so we have a great body of evidence as a pre-project condition. And we think that this is an important location to continue monitoring to show that hopefully things are getting better, not worse, and that we can all use that to move forward on future projects. We won't always have this opportunity because many other locations around the Tahoe Basin have a lot of other development in the same watershed, and you won't be able to just focus on the effects from vegetation management treatment. So it's really important that we monitor bioassessment in that location. With other dischargers and other permits, we have always allowed a discharger to rely on someone else to collect the information. So if TRPA is taking samples and using the protocols at that site, that information the Forest Service can submit to comply with the permit requirement. It doesn't matter who performs it or who pays for it. The important thing is that it's a condition of this project because of the activity that's proposed in the Saxon Creek watershed. And it's very consistent with where the state water board and the regional boards are going statewide. I don't know if you're aware, but the new statewide construction permit requires bioassessment monitoring for large projects. I think it's a 100-acre or 300-acre threshold of disturbance. And, this project is 10,000 acres over several sub-watersheds, and no one place are they scraping the earth like they would be for, say, a subdivision. But there is a high level of disturbance in this particular sub-watershed, and this is a unique opportunity to kind of isolate that. So that's why we are requiring bioassessment monitoring. So I think I've answered a couple questions that Nancy brought up about mitigation, about bioassessment. I think in general, because we had to go through the CEQA process separately, it was a struggle for us to, as a lead agency, even though our role is water quality only, because we were serving as California's lead agency under CEQA, we had to make sure that the level of detail related to mitigation measures for all resource areas was sufficient to meet the California law. And I agree it got cumbersome in terms of some of that language ended up in our permit when it could have maybe just stayed in the environmental document, but somehow we had to show that the additional details and the mitigation measures were going to be accomplished. And Kim might be able to help me a little bit about how some of that language ended up in the permit that Nancy brought up about things that we normally don't review or pay attention to, like public safety, for instance, recreational access. We had to just be sure there was a specific plan in order to comply with CEQA.
Well, and specifically here, in order to do a mitigated negative declaration, there can't be any impacts that weren't able to be mitigated to less than significant levels. So when we're going through the checklist that CEQA provides, and it's in our in the back part of our permit in Appendix H, when we go through the aesthetics and the biology and those different sections that CEQA lays out, we had to pick out from those parts of the project that they were that the Forest Service was committing to identify how impacts would be mitigated and connect those dots. And so sometimes, I mean, it is out of the realm of what we do, but that's the only way in order to connect those dots and say, here's an impact and here's the mitigation, how is the only way we could move forward with a mitigated neg deck once we're moving forward on our own as a lead agency. Otherwise, we would have to do an environmental impact report.
How did the question about, was it flame height, how did we get into that?
Well, and that, again, some of these mitigation measures and these BMPs are the Forest Service's own proposal, their own BMPs.
So why should that be in our permit?
Some of it has to do with ensuring that the mitigation measure is actually being implemented, that will be done. It's not just in the Forest Service EIS, but that it is a requirement of, you know, in the condition of the project. Some of the stuff related to burning does have a correlation to water quality in terms of the amount of damage to the soil and things like that. So that was one of the original reasons we've always looked at burn plans, and we have BMPs related to spacing of the piles and how much fuel is burned at one time and that type of thing in terms of looking at damage to vegetation and soils. But I agree with you that these other elements were really we were basically copying Forest Service BMP into our project permit so that you could see that is the commitment and that's a requirement under CEQA. But this is the part that I agree is a little.
But if the Forest Service is already following their own plan, then why does it need to be in our plan also?
Well, as the CEQA lead agency, we had to, where there was a potential impact, we had to identify the mitigation.
Could we just say, see Forest Service plan?
Well, and that's essentially.
Instead of explicitly listing it, why would we just say, see section such and such of Forest Service plan, instead of putting it all again in our plan, which apparently is causing grief.
Potentially. But I think where there was lack of detail that we...
Oh, no, I'm not saying where more detail was needed,
right,
where it wasn't in the Forest Service plan, but we felt it was required, then that makes sense. But where we're simply duplicating what's already in their plan seems to be redundant.
Well, then,
and unnecessary.
It is, but then it would also be incorporated by reference as part of this, so this pile right here would be that big. Because it would incorporate their document into...
Yeah, by reference, instead of actually printing it out.
It's essentially the same, it's sort of the same end result. They're going
to
do it there.
But CEQA does require it to be available and in part,
Okay, I understand.
The other, I think, the key thing about timing, obviously, we had a permit out April 2010. The Forest Service did not put out their final EIS until September 2011. During that year and a half, we were not consulted, and we'd already given them, they had our permit. They knew the level of details we were looking for mitigation measures. So I don't have any information about the delay that was caused during that time that the Water Board was not involved. So since they signed their EIS in January, we're here before you in April. That's 3 months. That I don't see there was any delay. We got this on your agenda as quickly as we could based on having a final EIS in our hand this January. So we moved very quickly to circulate the mitigated neg deck. In fact, we circulated it in advance of receiving the final EIS and the record of decision. We had a draft. We had their final before their objection period and circulated the mitigated negative declaration. So I can assure you that Water Board staff was expediting this project to get it before you. The other issue about the timber waiver versus the WDR, some more related on that, is that this project, I think, as Nancy mentioned, initially we did think there were significant, there was the potential significant environmental impacts. I think this project now, the way it's being proposed, and the addition of a number of BMTs and commitments to do restoration and put roads to bed and do various things, we are now saying there are no significant impacts. That because of that finding, we could put this project under the timber waiver. However, the timber waiver has set conditions that the board adopted in 2009 related to operating on wet soils, related to specific protocols for measuring soil moisture at certain depths, and there are buffer zones that in some cases may be more stringent than the buffer zones in this set of WDRs. So the Forest Service is welcome to apply for coverage under the timber waiver and then meet the conditions of the timber waiver. The other challenge with the timber waiver is that we need project level details right up front, and the way I would see the South Shore project proceeding, because we don't have project level details right now for the 10 years of operation, they would be coming to us annually to get coverage under the waiver and to get their stream environment zone prohibition exemptions each year, and getting their grading variances each fall, and because that's the way the waiver is set up, is for all those things to happen kind of, you know, on an annual basis and on a project application basis, and the level of detail required by the project application, we don't think the Forest Service could meet at this point for this summer's project, let alone the 10 years. So the WDRs provide them this regulatory certainty of having your authorization, not having to come to the board, not having to get a separate exemption or a variance from the executive officer, that it's within the staff's ability to review their annual operating plans and show that it meets the intent of the WDRs and let them proceed.
So our staff has some flexibility as to how things are actually implemented. So we expect that there'll be some amount of give and take between what actually happens with our staff and the Forest Service staff working together, mm-hmm. seeing what's actually happening on the ground and making appropriate tuning as needed.
Exactly. Yeah,
I think the whole board's main concern, I think, and we've expressed it previously, is that things get done on the ground to mitigate fire danger and mm-hmm. reduce fuels. That's really got to be what our focus is, mm-hmm. and we should not be trying to make it totally perfect if it slows down mm-hmm. reducing fuels.
Dr. Horn, any questions?
Well, a number of references have been made to projects that have been conducted on the Nevada side of the lake, Round Hill and Spooner, and I'm wondering if staff has any comments about the monitoring that was done on those projects.
We've been reviewing those reports, and we have Bruce Worden, Dr. Worden, who's our soil scientist here tonight, PhD soil scientist, has been looking at that. He may be able to answer some specific questions, but I can also tell you from my own experience and over the years of Forest Service projects in the basin is that projects tend to perform better on the Nevada side, and there's a lot less rain on the Nevada side than there is on the California side. And I have observed, I've been out on field trips in the past too, where standard BMPs tend to be quite effective on the Nevada side, and they're just not subjected to the same kinds of weather that we get on the west shore of the basin. So it's not always a clear, you can't always take the information from the Nevada side and apply that it's going to perform the same way on the California side. So that, but that being said,
just before Bruce comes up, can you comment about the sort of acres of SEZs, what percentage of the SEZs are on the Nevada side versus in the South Shore project area?
Well, I think, in the Tahoe Basin in general, you have, as you can see, the lake itself is a very large surface area in relative to the actual watershed boundaries in the Tahoe Basin. So the drainages are relatively small compared to the surface water here. But on the east shore, you generally have much smaller stream systems that are pretty much perpendicular to the ridges. On the south shore, you have the Upper Truckee River and Trout Creek, and you have one of the biggest meadow complexes that exists in the entire Tahoe Basin, and for that matter in the Sierra Nevada. I mean, it's significant in terms of the amount of flat land that exists here that is predominantly meadows and stream environment zones. And then along the west shore, you end up with, again, some steeper situations. You have 64 streams that enter into the basin, but the Upper Truckee and Trout Creek comprise some of the largest flow of water into the basin. I don't know what the numbers are. I don't know if Doug or Chuck remember, but
it's a lot.
But it is hugely significant that all the water from this area drains through these, you know, main two tributaries. And we have a lot of SCZs, as we saw in the Taylor Creek area where Fallen Leaf connects to the lake. And so South Shore has a lot more stream environment zones than other areas of the Tahoe Basin.
Doug Smith, supervising geologist. Now, as much as all of us would like to have Bruce come up here and answer all these technical questions about this, I think it's premature. And the reason is the Forest Service staff and the Water Board staff have worked out a process, and it's specified in the WDR that the Forest Service can propose a demonstration project to alter some of the conditions and do things, and they can present some scientific information, and we will review it. So what we have worked out with their staff under this condition, following this, if this WDR were adopted, that they can propose to do things, present their science, and we would get together as staffs and review those, figure out what questions this demonstration project would need to answer. And so I think it wouldn't be fair to their staff or ours just getting our soils expert up here to answer your questions on this at this time.
Well, I mean, I just want to make the point that a lot of very general statements have been made, and that without any evidence to support them. And
well,
you know, so I just want other board members to be aware of that.
And I concur. A lot of statements have been made. We are currently reviewing a lot of that documentation right now. We don't have any conclusions on that from the staff level.
I mean, I can't assess the validity of these statements because I have seen no evidence. Either way.
While I'm up here, I wanted to point out just a couple of...
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
I have three more comments, cards, and three more comments. And I'd like Jack Landy. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
Good evening, or maybe good night, board members. I am the Lake Tahoe Basin Coordinator for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. It's nice to address you again on matters concerning the Lake Tahoe total maximum daily load, this time in reference to the South Shore Fuels Project. As EPA expressed in our written comments on both the draft EIS and on the tentative WDR, we understand both the urgency of and the difficulties posed by this project, and we hope that our comments will result in a project that's both effective and appropriately accounted for in the effort to restore Tahoe's clarity consistent with the TMDL. We stated both in our comments on the EIS and the WDR that land subject to fuel reduction should be monitored and modeled so as to estimate project impacts on fine sediment and nutrient loading to Lake Tahoe. While the Forest Service and Water Board responded in both cases that individual projects should not be held to the basin-wide load reductions required by the TMDL, as Doug mentioned, neither response addressed the actual comment. The final EIS response to comments refers to the Forest Service BMP Effectiveness Monitoring Program, which nowhere addresses the TMDL. However, I am encouraged to hear Sue Norman's description of the Forest Development's TMDL tracking and reporting system, which I look forward to seeing. The Water Board's response to EPA's comments states that staff is working with forest management agencies to devise metrics for tracking and reporting, quote, basin-wide load reduction efforts, and that load estimation will be done on a basin-wide scale, not a project scale. EPA does not understand this response, as it has been recognized since the early days of TMDL development, that while existing pollutant loading can and must be determined on, based on a basin-wide analysis of land use, the impacts of load-affecting activities can only be calculated on a project or catchment basis. It is therefore appropriate, in our view, to include TMDL-related water quality monitoring and modeling in project-specific permits or WDRs in the absence of existing basin-wide protocols or even a timeline by when these will be developed. We continue to suggest that the WDR should include a requirement for the Forest Service to develop a project-specific monitoring, TMDL monitoring and load estimation plan that they will follow until project-level monitoring and modeling is superseded by a basin-wide tracking and reporting approach. Even once basin-wide tracking and reporting is undertaken, the information provided will be site-specific or should be, and therefore best gathered on a project-by-project basis. We furthermore believe that the recent draft modeling report on the South Shore Fuels Project and basin-wide fuel strategy that was referred to earlier provides both a methodological and the factual basis for such a requirement, despite some of the conservative or worst-case aspects of the analysis. Although it shows that the Water Erosion Prediction Project model, as adapted to Tahoe Basin following several rounds of SNPLMA research, can produce anomalous results and has issues, that should be addressed in an adaptive management process, and can be and this model can be used to support both project scale and basin-wide loading estimates. Depending on the assumptions and constraints placed on the model, these estimates may indicate potentially significant water quality impacts from certain fuels reduction approaches, most notably whole tree skidding, and could help point to potential mitigations in the field to reduce those impacts. I guess I'd conclude by saying that given the resources being devoted to urban stormwater load reduction estimation and reporting, it would be unfortunate if a compatible level of effort is not expended on other source categories, especially for an undertaking of the magnitude of the South Shore Project, considering that it is the first major forest management project to be permitted following TMDL adoption. Thanks for your consideration. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Keith, do you have any questions?
What do you think it would cost to implement your recommendation?
I'm afraid I don't care.
It's got a cost.
Yes.
It'll reduce the amount of work done on the ground.
I think my suggestion is that a monitoring plan be developed primarily by the permittee for consideration by the board, and I suppose there would be a negotiation that would follow. I think some of the monitoring, especially under various versions of the WEP model that have been developed for the Tahoe Basin, that monitoring is, or that data to populate the model can be obtained without field monitoring, but a better monitoring or a better modeling effort would require some field data, and that could be costly.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have Martin Goldberg with the Lake Valley Fire Protection District.
Chairman and members of the board, voice is held all day. Some people are saying it's quite soothing. I'm rather annoying in my head right now, but I'll try and get through this. Yes, I'm Martin with Lake Valley Fire Protection District. I run the fuels program for the district and do defensible space inspections and so forth. The South Shore project is entirely within the Lake Valley Fire Protection District. And as you know, the Lake Valley Fire Protection District was part of the Forest Service and being the first responders to the Angora fire. And we all know that the Tahoe Basin Fire Commission and we discussed the briefly comments on finding 12, the importance of over-regulation and the importance of not allowing regulation to get in the way of doing this important job of fuels reduction. So I'm going to echo that on behalf of the private landowners within the Lake Tahoe Basin Fire, or within the Lake Tahoe, excuse me, within the Lake Valley Fire Protection District. Make sure that that is understood and heard. We really don't have a choice tonight but to approve this South Shore plan. 8 years in the making is just too long, and we should all be ashamed. I'm a government employee as well. There are many of us are here. We could do better. And I say that because I believe it was 2008, I stood in front of the board and talked about the importance of putting together a collaborative effort under the handbook process, which was discussed this evening by Michael Hogan. And I feel as though that it didn't happen, and there was opportunity for it to happen, and it didn't. I think that we need to strive to work together, and I echo what Nancy Gibson said earlier too about, you know, regarding how we work together, and that we shouldn't look back and we need to look forward, and I agree. You know, if I may borrow from Michael's slides, you know, he talked about the outcome, and he left, but you know, we need to develop an outcome-based process. We need to follow it, and I believe right now we can start with the outcome of being, you know, the goal of a fire-safe community, and that is the direction that we should look forward to. And now we need to begin to build a process by which all future projects can be based. You have worked towards meeting the goals of the commission report. I recognize that. A lot of what the commission report had asked of the regional board to do, they have done. Now we need to do one more push. We need to get a process in place by which we work collaboratively. I listened to both sides. I listened to Lahontan staff. I listened to Forest Service staff. And there's so much inconsistency. One person thought that this had been the case, or that this had been the direction. Another had thought that this was the reason why, for example, on the timber waiver, I heard from regional board staff that it was the Forest Service's desire to do the timber waiver. And then I heard from the Forest Service staff that that wasn't the case at all. So we have failed in making this process happen, and we really need to not allow that in the future. And I hope you encourage the handbook process and the collaborative process, and I think it begins tonight by approving this WDR and NECDEC. Any questions?
Dr. Horn? Peter?
Thank you.
Eric?
No, thanks.
Thank you. I have one last statement. Speaker card. Jeff Holland.
Thanks for letting me make a couple of these statements. I have four or five statements here on the WDR on best management practices mitigation measures. I'm a contractor. I've been up here since 1993. I've covered somewhere between 12 and 13,000 acres of fuel reduction projects, all mechanically. 90% of those were fuel breaks adjacent to all the houses. I've worked with Lahontan, TRPA, Forest Service, all the private people around the lake. Most of the time it's been pretty good. There's a couple things I'm concerned about that are going to raise the cost of doing some of the fuel break work that's in here. And one of the main things is number four. And I'll try to be brief and not read it. But
can you say, can you be specific when you say number four, where you were?
Well,
to?
This is what I'm on. I'll just show you.
Okay. Okay. So you're talking about?
Yeah, it's on the next page.
Okay. So the first. So we're talking about paragraph four.
Yeah,
of
paragraph
the findings.
Or yeah, item four, because you have item 1 through 90.
Anyways, with shortening this thing up, since it's late, I won't really read it, but I will give you what I think. Item number four is allowing LaHont to take 30 days to 30 days to approve a crossing or a change in the general plan. And a lot of times out in the woods, and primarily on Forest Service ground, some of the ground is so thick and so dense of trees, you can miss an entire little stream course or shoot an arc sight or anything. And once we get in there and we start harvesting the wood, we'll run across the wet area that was unforeseen, like I said, stream, arc sight, or something.
It's attachment F that he's referring to.
Page 4-125.
So anyhow, I'd like you guys to consider, at least on timber operations, we have a very short season. 6 months is a maximum. Most of the time it's about 5 months because of weather. 30 days is real tough to try to work with. Out in the woods, it can cause a lot of problems. And most of the time, I've worked with Doug Cushman. He's been pretty good about trying to get out quickly, but I'd hate to see somebody use that to stop a project. And we come across about 3 incidences a year that we need to be able to call LaHont up or the representative and get them out there to try to make a quick decision so we can keep our operations going. And that would be something I'd like you to consider. So next thing would be item number 6. And
hang on just a moment.
Excuse me. I think that I heard our staff commit tonight to answering these sorts of questions as quickly as possible within a day or two. And the 30 days is sort of like this is the maximum we ever think it would take. And so I think you... if you could rely on a quick answer for this sort of question. Is that not correct? Yeah. I'm
well,
getting nods of yes over there.
I'm gonna give you a nod of yes, but I'm also going to give you a nod of I've been up here 17 years, and I've dealt with multiple agencies up here. Yes, and okay. If you have an issue on the ground that maybe two people don't agree on, you have to be able to come to terms in quicker than 30 days. And I've had 2 incidences in my career up here where I got delayed for almost a month through the agencies. And, you know, it cost me over $200,000 sitting waiting because there was a pissing match. So I just suggest that if you don't change it, you understand that... in the timber operations with a short season, it'd be nice that there's some way of getting somebody out in the brush. I'll leave it to you guys. I'm not going to protest it one way or the other. It's just an issue. On number 6, it's about the moisture in the watershed. It's being changed to monitor 2 to 10 inches. We have monitored, at least as far as I know, with LaHont and the Forest Service, over the past 10 years, we've been monitoring 4 to 8 inches. And to my knowledge, the Forest Service has done a good job either letting me work or not work, because I haven't heard any complaints, for the most part, from LaHont or TRPA with that monitoring system that's been in place. And by changing that from 4 to 8 and moving that to a 2 to 10, unwarranted in my opinion, could cost anywhere between 4 to 6 weeks of operation up here a year. And what that will do is raise the cost 25% to 30% that contractors such as myself have to charge the government to do the same projects. This is probably the highest place in Region 5 for fuels reduction work because we're the farthest from any markets to take our material to. And So we're already approaching that average $2,500 an acre cost of doing fuels reduction. And I'd hate to see that get pushed up into the $3,500 area. So I'd like you to consider at least not adopting the 2 to 10 and doing the 4 to 8, because I don't believe there's ever been an issue up to now. We're just changing it for no reason from that, what I know.
Could I have a response from Lori?
I'd be happy to respond to both of the two, and these are from BMP.
Hey, don't use my notes. I got three more real quick, and then is that all right?
Absolutely.
I'll block you, though. So,
chop down the skinny guys.
All right, that was number six on the water moisture. If that could be considered. One of my bigger concerns is number 11, and that is asking the Forest Service to adhere to the California Forest Practice Rules or Act. I don't believe, and maybe that wasn't thought through, I'm not sure how you have the power to ask the federal government to do that. If that did happen, it'd be the only place it's ever happened in Region 5. I do know the federal laws pretty well. And the other thing is between what you're going to approve in this and having the Forest Service have to adhere to the California Department of Forestry, you're going to find a lot of contradictories in the rules. I'm not going to stand up here and go through them, but I know both sets of them pretty well, and I think you're gonna have a lot of great issues that are gonna cause you problems. And the other thing is that you're asking Forest Service people that have been trained for many years and that are professional people for monitoring out there to learn a whole new system of doing things. And I'd like you to consider backing off of that one. Okay, moving on to 13D, which is the slash removal in the SEZ. I was fortunate enough to be the contractor that did the Heavenly Creek SEZ project, which most all the findings are, this whole WDR is wrote on. Worked with all the agencies really well. Here it's talking about using a forwarder to pick up the slash, and it did work at the time very well. And very quickly, before I came up here, I did hear you guys talking about, hey, the Forest Service can have another test and do something else, but technology changes rapidly. And we've now figured out a way to do it, a better job of picking up the slash with a little less impacts than what we were doing 5 years ago in this particular test that they're referring to. So I'd like, if that stays in there, I'd like to just make sure that Lahontan understands that I'd like you guys to be able to quickly adopt another way if it's shown that it will work. Because that's kind of become, the way I did it then, we don't do that anymore because we found a way to be less soil disturbing. And I would think that that's the most ultimate goal working in an SEZ. Mm-hmm. And also you talk about the depth of slash, whether Lahontan will approve the depth of slash or not. And there again, I'm not sure why it would really matter since you're a governing board on water and sediment in the creeks as long as the Forest Service is monitoring those and we're not moving soils, it should be up to them to decide how much slash they're going to have allowed into the SEZs. Okay, last one is 42. And I don't want to turn my page. Basically, it's talking about the roads. Coming from a dirt road to a paved road. My operation goes from a dirt road to a paved road probably somewhere between 20 and 25 different places in the basin every year. And on the South Shore EA particularly, there's a lot of access points on the pavement. And although the rock works well, but so do chips in the right conditions. If it is dry ground, middle of the summertime, chips keep the road. If you put your encroachments in chips, it seems to keep the roads just as clean as doing it in rocks. So I'd hate to see you back yourself into a corner to where everything has to be rock, because also up here in the basin, we have to have a weed-free rock that costs three times more than a regular rock to lay down. So that 25 feet of rock is a $900 cost to the project, which is, we're talking about the Forest Service projects, just for the rock. I did four of those places this past year. It was about $900 a time. And that's just for the rock. And then it's another $500 with equipment, time, and stuff. So you got roughly $1,500 in there. So I'd like to see the Forest Service have a little bit of leeway there, that if we have dry conditions and we are not tracking sediment onto the roadway, that we could use chips instead of rock. And then obviously when the roads are wetter, which we never get to use anyways, we would put rock down if we were going to do that. Other than that, you guys already covered it, but basically item 59 through 90, I wasn't sure why LaHont is even overseeing any of that, because it's already being overseen by the Forest Service, and I might say very well, because I have to deal with them on all that stuff. But nevertheless, thanks for your time.
Thank you. And Larry, do you have a response to those five items?
Doug Cushman, Senior Water Resource Control Engineer. I'm the head of the non-point source unit, supervisor George Sella, who wrote this permit. And we'll address all of the things that Jeff just brought up. BMP number 4, I think it was page 4-125, and all the issues he brought up were related to attachment F, BMP number from there. I'll start with 4 was the lowest one, so it's subsequent pages after that. The 30-day requirement there, George addressed a little bit in his slide. That is for the annual operating plans that we have yet to receive from the Forest Service. So it is anticipated that every April, they will have the winter period, the slow season, when they're not out in the woods very much, or the preponderance of their staff are not in the woods, can develop the next season's operating plan and submit that to us, which we will then turn around within 30 days or earlier. It will not exceed 30 days. In terms of what Jeff is specifically talking about, the fix in the field, we're here on this 8 acres, and we got a problem. The equipment's running, the gas is burning. We need to figure out how we can get around this specific location, this minor thing that was not visible from the 1,000-foot level, but when we're standing right next to it. And that's the one that we have committed to being there within 48 to 72 hours to go out and figure out how can we work this out. South Shore Project is sufficiently close to our office that we can, I think, pass the laugh test on credibly saying we will be there ASAP on those things. The notion of a crossing, of a 30-day review, that's for the annual operating plan, where they're proposing 1,300 acres of mechanical, 2,200 acres of hand treatment or cut-to-length treatment, and they haven't given us what they plan to do, where they plan to operate, the specifics of we're going to build this temporary road here with what sort of outstripping we're going to decommission those roads. That's the stuff we're looking for, a 30-day review period. And should ostensibly be occurring during the slow season, we'd get those in April and would be able to turn that around within 30 days so that when the dry season comes and they're ready to go with their main operating season in the summertime, we've already done that review and it's happened. With regard to BMP
Number six, the soil moisture depth. This is another one of those issues that George addressed in his presentation, saying this WDR offers greater flexibility to the Forest Service relative to using the timber waiver, which is our other permitting option for this project. Timber waiver has criteria and conditions, general and category specific. A general condition of the timber waiver is that soils shall be dry from the 0 to 12 inch depth. We do not have the flexibility under that timber waiver to decide which conditions a project shall adhere to. They must adhere to all conditions of the timber waiver to enroll under that timber waiver. So this WDR allows a 2 to 10 inch depth for soil moisture measurements. The 4 to 8, that's been going on in Nevada. So under CEQA and the way we've approved this, this WDR gives them greater flexibility in the 2 inch depth. We're all right with that, operating with moist soils on the 2 inch depth. That's primarily going to be come up in the fall or after summertime thunder bumper, where there hasn't really been a whole lot of precedent antecedent moisture, and it's the surface area, the level of disturbance that we're anxious from operating on those wet soils. We prefer to have a little bit of moisture and dust abatement to go with the timber operation. So that would be something that is standard operating procedure for timber operations, to put some dust layer, to have a water truck keep the dust down, or if it's dry in the summertime and there's a thunderstorm comes through, if it's only wet to the first 2 inches, they can keep operating, as opposed to the timber waiver would shut them down until that's dry. In the spring, when it's snow melt and you have groundwater up higher, that's the problem at the lower elevation, so that the 10-inch depth, that we would like soils to be dry from above to a 10-inch depth to have the soil have the structure and capacity to withstand the compaction pressure of that equipment. So the 2 and 10 are generally would be at different times of the year. 2-inch moisture in the 0 to 2-inch level would be during summer, late fall, into the later season operating period. They extend that beyond what the timber waiver would shut them down at zero on a soil moisture. This lets them operate if there's just a little bit of rainfall or even snow. Just last year, they were operating with a little bit of snow. It's not going below 2 inches in depth as it melts and keeps them operating a little longer. So that's a flexibility that this WDR does provide for our service. The timber waiver does not allow, which the timber waiver, to say this again, I'm repeating myself, is a 0 to 12 inch depth on the soil. The third issue Jeff brought up was BMP number 11 with regard to the water bar spacing and application to the Forest Service of forest practice rules specifications. That pretty much came right out of our timber waiver also, and again is a CEQA issue. We are approving this project. We're asking you to approve this project using a mitigated negative declaration. The forest practice rules have clearly passed and survived all kinds of challenges with regard to CEQA. That's our avenue to get to that. We've also asked, the Forest Service has not provided anything else. We have asked them extensively in October when this came out, November, can they provide different BMPs? Are there BMPs they cannot live with in here? And we worked through a few. Some of them are addressed in the late revisions or in the differences from the tentative to the proposed. This one specifically with the forest practice rules was not brought up by the Forest Service to us. It's the first we've heard about it today from Jeff just now. It's a CEQA issue. Allows us without any Achilles heel from a CEQA standpoint. It survived CEQA, the forest practice rules. They've been around for years and years and years. BMP 13D, which I believe refers to removal of slash on a cut-to-length project.
Or depth of slash.
Depth of slash. And removal. So they should operate on slash and remove it. It also refers to BMP 21B, which is on base page 134-132. And recognize one, this is only in SEZ areas. I think the project has cut to So it's only in the SEZ areas where this is a requirement. It's to remove the slash to a 90% ground cover shall be retained. So not moving all the slash out, leaving it covering 90% of the ground at a 2-inch depth, average depth. Some of that is the literature out there says that if residual slash and biomass is left over 4 inches, 2 inches to 4 inches, it really inhibits regrowth of vegetation within that zone, which would limit the capability of the SEZ to perform its function of filtering and set, treating water before it gets to creeks.
Excuse me. I just wanted to jump in here and try to help you out on this real quick. I think what Mr. Holland was asking for, and I think a real easy way for us to deal with this, is he was suggesting that there may be other equipment or other methods than the CTL forwarder to be used. I believe that's what he was asking. And so I think if we could add in here, or equivalent...
Or other allowable low ground pressure equipment?
In there. I think that would probably get to his concern. I think
I'd like to hear from him.
Yes, I was... Mr. Hall?
Yeah.
So on 13D, we were thinking about adding in there or other low ground pressure equipment.
Yeah, I think that gives us at least some area that we can work on the ground, and we're not stuck just to a method that we did
right
6 years ago.
Yeah,
okay.
Okay, thank you. That helps considerably. And I think there's room. His last issue that he brought up was number 42, where native surface roads intersect with paved county roads, addressing tracking, soil tracking onto that. Our issue is soil sediment is not tracked onto a road, which would then end up in a storm drain and routed through the conveyance system into the lake. So other methods, our concern is performance-based. Don't get sediment onto the pavement where it ends up getting washed. And there's clearly room for us to modify that as needed.
So if we approve this tonight, you could modify that at staff level?
Well, we should do it right now.
It would happen right now, tonight. That's a standard procedure as the board looks at things. Of what would we like to change? We put it into it, and Harold would sign it sometime next week after we get those things.
Well, do you have some language that you could...
Or equivalent cover?
Or some equivalent method that prevents soil tracking onto paved roads.
I see summer coming on here.
So 3-inch plus competent rock or equivalent
treatment that prevents.
That's all you say. It already says prevent tracking. You say equivalent method.
Yeah. So we'd say or equivalent method after that. For at least a distance of 25 feet to prevent tracking the mud.
We've gone through all the speaker cards, and I'd like to bring this back to the on board.
So did you get that?
Any observations, Mr. Hughes?
I'm inclined to accept the staff recommendations to approve the CEQA document in the waste discharge report.
Yep. I am also with these two revisions we've just been talking about.
We also have...
And the late revisions, yes. I'm sure you're on board with those. Yes,
Doug, did you want to...
No.
We just thought we have them.
Yeah, we have.
Okay.
Yeah. Mr. Pumphrey.
That would be my position as well.
Dr. Horn.
I would like to move that we adopt this order with the late revisions. And as for my comments, I'd like to say a few things. When I was interviewed by the governor's staff whether, you know, they were going to recommend appointing me to be a board member on this board. They were concerned mostly about two things. Would I protect Lake Tahoe? And what were my greatest concerns about forestry practices? So, I mean, I'm saying this to this room to let you know that at very high levels in the state government, what goes on in this basin is of supreme importance. And it's something that I take very seriously. We have come, of course we want to protect our communities. Of course we want to reduce fuel loads. I have hiked the Tahoe Rim Trail twice, and I tell you, there are stands that I'm afraid to walk through on a clear summer day. There is so much out there, it is scary. And we do need to do this work. We have come so far since the fire commission. The timber waiver, consider how much has been treated, how many acres have been treated under the new timber waiver since the Angora fire. I mean, there are roads you drive around the basin where it looks completely different today than it did 10 years ago. So, you know, we're making a lot of progress. This waiver, this WDR has cut to length happening in SEZs. That's a step forward. So I think we're making a lot of progress. There are good reasons why this project, because it's so big, doesn't fit under the timber waiver. And also, it looks like a different animal, primarily because Lahontan had to be the lead agency on the CEQA. But those differences in this waiver or this WDR are, you know, it's wordsmithing. It doesn't make a difference in terms of what people can do on the ground. I mean, it's bowing to the legal gods. It's not a substantive difference from what I heard this evening. So I congratulate everybody on a lot of hard work and a job well done, and look forward to more progress this summer on the ground.
I would open the floor for a second.
I'd like to second the motion.
I have 2 seconds. Okay. Eric.
I'd like to second Dr. Horn's motion.
And further discussion.
Just to thank everybody, repeat Dr. Horn's thanking everybody for all the work that they did on this. Sort of underscore the two or three people that reminded us that all that work is never over. So it's really reminding you that all that work is never over. It was good to hear that people have the ability to work together. It was good to hear that people would like to join together and looking forward. There is so much to do that the only way any of it can get done is to take that attitude. And it was certainly good to hear it in the room tonight.
Keith, do you have any comments?
Nothing.
I just wanted to say, to get things done in the Lake Tahoe Basin, we need to work collaboratively together, all the agencies, all the folks living here. With that, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Passed. Thank you all. We will adjourn until 8:30 tomorrow morning. We may need to continue the meeting.
Yeah, I'd be glad to continue working.
Eric?
I can, although, tomorrow morning I'm staying over anyway.
I agree.
Well, that was my fault.
You needed to get all done.
I'd like to be able to get out of here with my storm and go to the weather.
This time you guys are planning, complaining to me.
As early as the roads are safe.
Well, in that case, let's proceed.
We're continuing.
We'll continue the meeting. I guess I have everyone's attention.
Let me tell you what we have planned in terms of timing for tomorrow, and or at least for the rest of the meeting. We have the executive officer's report, which is about an hour. I can do it in less, but probably I can do it in half an hour or less. I'd be happy to do that. We have two items that on closed session that we think will take about 10 minutes each. Other than, you know, it depends on if board members want to talk more about them. That's up to you. Obviously, you can tell us on that. And then I think you have some time on personnel that you want to spend some time in closed session. So your choices are we could do the EO report now, continue that, or you could do the closed session now, and if some of you need to leave during the EO report, you don't need a quorum to continue that item.
Okay.
It's
that makes sense.
It does.
So maybe doing your closed session now would be a better use of your time.
Is there a way that we could start, since we're all staying in the same building, earlier than 8:30?
We didn't notice it for earlier. We noticed it for 8:30,
yeah,
right?
I think you can start earlier than that.
We could start a closed session before then.
We didn't notice it, though.
No.
Who cares? We're all here by ourselves.
No, I mean, we could do the closed session earlier, but, I mean, it doesn't... Why don't we just do the closed session now?
Let's do the closed session now.
Let's do it now. We're going into closed session for two items.
Three items.
Now.
And then we're going to adjourn for after closed session, adjourn and do the executive officers...
Tomorrow morning
at 8:30.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, we're recording.
Okay.
Sorry, go ahead. Yeah, you don't need it. You can just talk and it'll pick it up.
We're coming out of closed session for those three items. No report of action. We will adjourn until tomorrow morning at 8:30.
And I think with this few people, you can use it if you want to or not.
Yes, we will convene as a subcommittee, as we do not have a quorum. So a subcommittee of the Manhattan Regional Water Quality.
I got to go. I'll call you back. Bye.
I'll go through part of the opening statement. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the regular meeting of a subcommittee of the Manhattan Regional Water Quality Control Board. My name is Don Jardine. I'm Markie, and I'm chairman. I want to thank members of the public for coming to our meeting. We do a better job when we participate in issues that come before us. At this time, I'd like to introduce other members of the regional board, Dr. Amy Horn from Truckee, Eric Sandell from Truckee. As this is a subcommittee, we'll spot in. The executive officer is Harold Singer. Mr. Singer, will you introduce members of the staff?
Sure. I'll introduce Sue Genera, the board secretary, Lori Kemper, the assistant executive officer, Chuck Curtis, Mike Pleziak, Doug Smith, Richard Booth, and Kim Niemeyer. Kim is on the staff of the State Water Resources Control Board as the board's attorney.
I look to counsel. Is there any need to go on with the opening statement?
No.
Okay. In that case, there was a reportable action of a closed session. last night. And I defer to Dr. Horn.
I am very pleased to announce that we have a new executive officer. Her name is Patty Schwartz, and details are to be worked out. But Patty has been a deputy secretary of Cal EPA under three governors and many different heads of Cal EPA. She has written a lot of Porter Cologne herself. So we're very fortunate to have her as our next executive officer.
Thank you, Dr. Horn. We had wonderful, wonderful candidates, I can tell you that. I had, I can only speak for myself. In that case, we'll push on to item 5, Executive Officer's Report.
So I'm going to go through some of the written material, and then I do have about three other things that I do want to cover. The first item that I want to cover is item number 1 on Nearshore. And on this one, I just want to go a little bit outside of what's in the written material. But clearly we're struggling a bit with how to deal with the Nearshore. The issue here in the Nearshore in Tahoe is obviously the visual effect of algae, both floating and attached algae, and some issues with clarity with sediment. The board in your basin plan, you do have a narrative standard, but a narrative standard is difficult to enforce. We also have some numeric standards which are met most of the time in some areas and some of the time in other areas. But it really tells us that our standards are probably not adequate to deal with the conditions that exist in the Nearshore. So we need to look at really how do we approach the Nearshore conditions. The written material describes a process that's ongoing that's been funded through the SMPLMA funding program. And it's a group of researchers that I think we have the benefit of a pretty large group of researchers that have worked on Tahoe for many years and I think understand a lot of the intricacies and complexities of the lake. And they're working pretty closely with the agencies on this project. And what, at this point, that we're looking at is to try to come up with, number one, some metrics to be able to at least measure the conditions in the Nearshore. So we have some way of looking at the Nearshore in more of a cumulative way rather than just individual constituents or individual numerics. So the researchers are looking at more of a way of similar to like a bioassessment type approach to the Nearshore, looking more at the holistic aspect of the Nearshore. The other thing that we're looking at, though, as agencies, is to look for an implementation strategy that we want to put forward that we think will improve conditions in the Nearshore while we're in the process of looking at these metrics and trying to develop some standards. And the researchers have really come forward by making a very emphatic statement of saying that this implementation strategy that you all developed as part of the Tahoe TMDL will have a positive effect in improving the Nearshore. They feel very confident in that. Obviously, they can't quantify the benefit. That's a much more complex process to do. But they do feel very strongly about the actions that are being implemented as part of the TMDL will have a positive effect by reducing sediment, reducing nutrients. One of the points that they made was that a lot of the phosphorus that comes into the lake is attached to the fine sediment. And so by removing the sediment, we'll also get quite a bit of phosphorus removal. What they're going to do, though, is they're going to put together some really good informational material that they're willing to stand behind that we can put out there and work towards a strategy that will put this forward you know, try to coalesce the agencies behind some actions to address some of the near-shore conditions while we're going through some more regulatory aspects of developing some metrics and some standards. the other thing that they're looking at is developing what would be called a conceptual model is, you know, what's really, what are the sources that are affecting the near-shore conditions? And that's really what's driving them towards this, looking at the implementation strategy for the TMDL, because the sources are very similar. Again, the point being is this is more of a qualitative look at things, not a quantitative look at things. But it will give people a sense of, oh, it's the same sources that are affecting the nearshore that are affecting the deepwater clarity. And the scientists are going to come forward with this. We expect something, I think, by late summer on this grant issue that's going to come forward. So we should have something by the fall to put forward on this. And I think it'll go a long way towards aligning people's thoughts about what we need to do at Tahoe. And even though we can't quantify the effect on the nearshore, I think we can say with a straight face and with a lot of research behind it that the kind of activities we're doing will have a positive effect on the nearshore. The second item that I want to cover is item three. It's the wetland grant. In this one, you know, we're looking at trying to protect more than just the typical wetlands that we all think about when we think of, you know, the Corps of Engineers definition of a wetland and our regulatory programs in the 404 program and the 401 program. But we're really trying to look at more riparian habitat and other benefits that are just beyond the strict definition of a wetland. And so, you know, as pointed out in this report, you know, first thing you need to do when you start looking at these kind of protective measures is to identify what it is we're trying to protect. And so that's what a lot of this work is doing, is taking some work that's been done in other areas of the state and really trying to adapt it for Sierra Nevada, for some of the riparian areas and the wet meadows in the Sierra Nevada. So we think this is a very positive program moving forward. One thing that wasn't stated in here, and actually it was, I think it was in the draft that was a little longer, that when we massaged it a bit, it came out. But I did want to make a point that this is not a Lahontan-only project. This project involves many, many different agencies, and we're working collaboratively with a number of different groups and individuals to move this forward. So while, you know, we've done a lot of heavy lifting on this to move it forward, we're not the only ones involved in this. The next item is item four that I want to talk about, and I did discuss this at the March meeting. This just sort of formalizes what I think we told you then, is that that we are moving back the consideration of the waiver to your next meeting, and it probably will be July. It could be June, but that will be in the southern part of the region, so we're not sure really where this is going, but
it'll be July.
It'll be July.
Bill Thomas doesn't believe that our region extends that far south.
Okay.
He won't show up in Barstow, I guarantee you. That could be a good reason. That could be the reason to bring it, but I don't think it's good.
You know, I think this item raises a few sort of big picture regulatory issues that we grapple with a lot, and I thought I'd take a few minutes and just to talk about that a bit. You know, we looked at this, and you know, this is not the only grazing going on in the region. And so, one of the concerns that have been raised through this process is why are we under permit and nobody else? And you know, this is a question of, well, who do you regulate? You know, how do you prioritize the resources that we have to move forward and try to use our authorities, and you know, frankly, we should have a lot of people under regulation throughout the state that currently aren't regulated. So, you know, this is a program of well, who do you regulate? Well, obviously, we looked at this and we said we have a number of impaired water bodies in this area. We have certain activities that we know are contributing to that impairment. We felt this was a good fit for a regulatory program rather than a TMDL. And so we really move forward in that regard. The other question that this raises is, how to regulate them. You've got a lot of tools in your toolbox in terms of regulations, and they go all the way from an individual set of waste discharge requirements, similar to what you imposed last night on the Forest Service, to general waste discharge requirements that could be applied to a number of different entities, or conditional waivers, either individual or a general conditional waiver. One of the key things that we need to look at when we do this is, when you do a conditional waiver, you establish conditions. There's no obligation for people to sign up for that conditional waiver. So you really, to go through an exercise with a conditional waiver, you really want to do it in an area where you have a number of stakeholders that are working together with you and are willing to sign up to this. And you've somewhat worked the conditional waiver so the conditions that you imposed, they feel somewhat comfortable with and are willing to sign up for it. Where waste discharge requirements, somebody doesn't have to raise their hand and say, I want to be regulated. You can adopt waste discharge requirements on someone who hasn't even applied for it. So from that perspective, one is more of a, I'll use the word voluntary tool, because you could adopt a waiver and no one could sign up for it. And there it is. From this perspective, we're looking at this group using the waiver because we've had some good cooperation with the ranchers in this area. We think we can adopt the kind of conditions that will move forward and improve water quality and still work with them on this. So that's the goal we're working on. And so that's the direction we're headed. The other big issue that comes up in this discussion, which you've faced in the past, and it deals with how do you deal with certain basin plan requirements that you have that may not fit really closely with what's going on in a specific area. And, you have a relatively, it's a basin plan that's been around for a while. It was adopted with, some amount of support data behind it, but it also covers the entire region. And, this is a good situation where you have a basin plan and you have conditions, and you have to look at it and say, well, if people can't meet the conditions that are in your basin plan, do you just sort of look the other way, or do you put them under a time schedule? How do you deal with that in the interim? Do you look for them to make improvements to comply with those requirements, to make improvements while you maybe change your basin plan? A good example of this is what the board did with Los Angeles Sanitation District with Paiute Ponds, where we somewhat acknowledged that maybe site-specific objectives were more appropriate there. The board adopted a set of waste discharge requirements. You put a schedule in there that gave them sufficient time to work with the board staff on developing site-specific objectives. You didn't force them to take specific actions to come into compliance with a number that you thought could be changed in the future. You have some room there to work on that when you're working with a state permit. You have very limited discretion when you're talking about an NPDES permit. But at least with a state permit, you have some discretion in that area. The other point that this brings up quite an interesting issue on is monitoring. And I think the discussion last night was quite interesting on the level of monitoring needed. Both during the initial discussion, I think Mike Hogan's presentation, hit pretty heavily on, we trust you, but show me. That's the other point here with monitoring is waivers do require monitoring. It's specific in the water code that you'd have to make a very specific finding about no possible impact to totally eliminate monitoring from a waiver. But you do have some discretion on that, and obviously, the use of monitoring when it's appropriate to show that either progress is being made or no progress is being made, how things are going, there's a time and place for monitoring. And I think right now we're working on trying to adjust that a little bit to maybe reduce the level of monitoring while things are improving, and then looking at some monitoring towards the end of the process to see how that level of improvement has been going before the next permit cycle or the next waiver cycle would come up. So. Just some thoughts about that to keep in mind when you consider that in July. The next item is item 5, the mercury control in reservoirs. And again, this is a statewide effort that's going on. As you can see from the map, there are many reservoirs in California that are listed as impaired water bodies, primarily due to mercury. The key here is that, with mercury and these reservoirs, this has a direct impact on human health. There's a lot of people in California that are subsistence fishermen that really, use these reservoirs very heavily and feed families out of these reservoirs. And we have found that a lot of the fish in many of these reservoirs have pretty high levels of mercury. And so, this is a real important concept to look at it, not just from the water quality perspective, but from the human health perspective. These are pretty complex sources when you talk about mercury. There's been a lot of these reservoirs are in the Sierras and the foothills, and a lot of mining activity that's gone on has affected these reservoirs over time. There's even some current, discharges probably from mining activities that are contributing mercury. There are some urban sources. There's air pollution, both probably generated in the state, but probably also out of state. So this is going to be a complex issue to deal with in terms of a source control, but there are some things that can be done. The other interesting thing that's being developed through this, though, is some reservoir management techniques. And what they have found is that by controlling reservoir levels and chemical aspects in the reservoir, they may be able to limit the amount of available mercury. The other thing that they're looking at is fisheries management, in that some fish don't accumulate mercury as rapidly as other fish, and that maybe by dealing with the fish species, we might be able to at least still provide subsistence fishing, but maybe not at higher levels of mercury that might be if different fish were in the reservoir. So this is going to be a very interesting process moving through both looking at source control, but also looking at the management of the reservoirs themselves. Next item is item 6, PG&E. And I wanted to talk about two topics, one of which is written up in here, and that's the deep aquifer chromium contamination issue. And then the second issue, which is not written up in here, is the whole house replacement water issue. So on the deep aquifer chromium issue, just a quick little background, just refresh all of your memories, that around the compressor station where the chromium was originally discharged to these unlined ponds, there's a shallow aquifer, and then there's a clay layer that separates it from the deep aquifer. That clay layer exists towards the north away from the compressor station a number of miles, but eventually basically pinches out. And so you don't have that separation between the upper aquifer and the lower aquifer as you move farther north across the railroad tracks and across Highway 58. And that's where PG&E, through some of the investigations that the board has required, has identified that they found chrome in the lower aquifer zones. And the indication, at least, or the theory behind it was that there was a number of irrigation wells in that area that were in the deeper zone, and they were, in fact, pulling the contamination from the shallow zone across the barrier and then down into the deeper zone in that area. So that was the speculation. We agree with that in concept. But what's the fix for that? Initially, the initial fix was to eliminate that deep pumping. And so PG&E has gone out and has acquired a number of the sites where that deep pumping was going on. Has replaced that with shallow wells, so we eliminate the downward pull of some of those deep wells in that area. The other aspect now is, what do you do to clean it up? And this is where it gets a little more complicated, in that normally we would go in and pump in the area where the contamination is. But that's what brought it there in the first place. So the concern there is, if we start pumping from the deep zone, we might, in effect, pull more contamination down. So the strategy at this point is to do some pumping in the shallow zone and try to reverse the gradient and actually cause an upward gradient in that area and be able to pull some of that contamination back up into the shallow zone and out some of these extraction wells. It's a plausible way of doing this. I think we're going to have to monitor it pretty closely to see if it actually is effective. But I think it's a good first start rather than going back and starting to pull stuff into the deep zone or potentially pulling more into the deep zone while we're trying to clean it up. So that's the approach that's being taken at this point. On the second issue, the whole house replacement water issue, a little bit of background on this. You know, the cleanup and abatement order that was issued last fall, it required two forms of replacement water for people, and I'll get into which people qualify for replacement water in a minute, but it required replacement water initially with bottled water, but then looked at it and said, well, you know, these people may be on bottled water for a long period of time, and we felt that it was more appropriate to provide really whole house replacement water for people so that they would be, you know, replaced in kind to what they were losing before. And a lot of it had to do with the length of time of cleanup, as I said. There was two triggers for replacement water that was built into the cleanup order. One was people whose domestic wells exceeded 3.1 parts per billion chromium or hexavalent chromium within a mile of the plume boundary. That was one trigger. And then the other trigger that we put into the order that we're still actually working on a bit is we also realized that there was a possibility that people's wells below 3.1 could also have been affected by the PG&E discharge. But, you know, there was no real number to pick that we had at the time. So we required PG&E to propose a statistical analysis that could be used to look at individual wells and see if there were trends, and if there were trends that indicated that that contamination was due to PG&E as opposed to natural conditions, that they would also then be required to or be allowed to be supplied with replacement water. PG&E has sent two letters in to us on the statistical analysis, and both of them pretty much took the position that they did not think that there was a statistical method that could achieve the intent of the order. And so they did not put up a proposal. I sent out a letter about almost 3 weeks ago now to pretty much all of the people in the Hinkley area and just basically saying, what do you all think about PG&E's proposal? Because obviously before I accepted it or rejected it, I wanted to get some other input to this. Because the options are either we could either impose our own statistical analysis, what that would be, we'd have to come up with something, or, you know, possibly there would be agreement that there really wasn't a statistical method and that we could amend the order to withdraw that part of the trigger. So we were looking for information that we could use to support one of those two positions or some other position. So right now, the only trigger for replacement water is the 3.1, and there's about 15 homes that are currently being provided replacement water under that trigger. But in addition, PG&E has voluntarily provided replacement water to a number of homes in the area. Their criteria is somewhat loose, but people that have chrome in their wells and that would like it, PG&E's been providing bottled water. And right now there's over 300 homes in the Hinkley area that are being provided water voluntarily by PG&E. So there's a large number in that area. So one of the other aspects of the cleanup and abatement order was that we required PG&E to perform a study of how would they provide replacement water that met this very low chromium requirement. And the reason for that is that right now, you know, one way of doing that would be to provide what are called point of entry systems, which is basically a treatment system that you put on the pipe coming into your house, and it treats all the water that comes into the house. The other kind of system that many of you have probably heard about is an under-sink type or a point-of-use type system. Well, those systems are certified by the California Department of Public Health, but they only certify those systems based on the state drinking water standard, or the MCL, which is 50 parts per million or per billion total chrome. That doesn't get us anywhere near the level of chrome, the low level of chrome that we're asking PG&E to provide the replacement water for. So we really needed to have some of these systems studied to see if they were capable of producing water at that level. We also wanted PG&E to look at other alternatives, such as providing a piped-in water system for the entire community, or trucking water into tanks, which was done in a small area there due to the nitrate problem we had before. So so we required PG&E to do this study. They gave us a work plan a number of months ago that we approved, and the report just came in on Monday on the replacement water alternatives. And just wanted to, it's a report that's about yay thick, but I just wanted to just run down the six alternatives that they looked at. One was connecting to an existing community water system. Number two was develop a new community water system, utilizing groundwater near the Mojave River. Three was develop a new community water system utilizing local groundwater as part of the chromium remediation program. So all of these would be a centralized treatment and distribution type system. All three of them would, they would put pipes in the street and they would be delivering water to each of the homes, similar to what a subdivision would expect in terms of the water system. The fourth alternative was a three-part alternative, but it was providing point-of-entry whole house water treatment. And they looked at three different methodologies, ion exchange, reverse osmosis, and then a ion exchange point-of-entry and a reverse osmosis under sink to deal with some of the constituents. So they looked at three different alternatives for that. They also looked at a fifth alternative, which was replace impacted wells with deeper wells, to see if that would suffice in terms of providing the quality of water that was needed. And then the sixth alternative was to truck water from a community water system, likely setting up tanks on people's property and filling those tanks on a regular basis and then providing that water into the house. So those were the six alternatives they looked at. They have suggested three alternatives moving forward in their proposal to deal with the current, the 15 homes that are under the required replacement water, and that is, is either digging a deeper well where it's possible, if they wanted that, a point of entry type system with a undersink RO system to do some polishing, and then the third alternative is to buy out the peoples if they just feel they don't want either one of those and they just want to be done with the problem. So that's the proposal that PG&E has put forward. The other thing that PG&E has put forward, which is a very interesting wrinkle in this entire process, is they are also proposing to make these same three options available to the 300 people plus potentially more that are not subject to the 3.1 trigger. Basically what they're saying is that they would be willing to offer those alternatives to anybody within a within 1 mile of the plume boundary that existed in December. And they feel that that sort of negates the need to go through a statistical process, because in effect it probably covers a larger group of people than would be covered by the statistical analysis. So, but they're putting that out as a voluntary program at this point, in order to deal with, I think, a number of different issues. So right now, I think what we're looking at is one of the key points in the cleanup order is that the regional board did not want to be in a position of requiring PG&E to do something that the community really didn't want. And so part of this process was to find out from the community what they were willing to accept, what they thought of the different alternatives that were being developed, and which ones or what suite of different alternatives might be appropriate for this community. And so that's a process that I think we're going to undertake real soon with PG&E's assistance to go out into the community and try to figure out a way to solicit people's ideas about the proposal and maybe even about some of the alternatives that are not being proposed by PG&E. Once the regional board accepts the proposal to provide alternative water, the order says that PG&E must implement that within 90 days of acceptance. My quick read of the proposal that came in from PG&E indicated that it would be unlikely that they would be able to do that within 90 days. They might need more time, and they would especially need more time to go beyond the 15 homes that are within the 3.1 trigger. So that's the status of that at this point. And you know, I think from at least my perspective, I think it's a positive move to look at a larger group of people to provide this replacement water to. Again, we haven't yet heard how the community feels about this. There's a community advisory meeting coming up later this month, and we'll be at that meeting. And I think there's already been at least a brief presentation to a subcommittee of the community advisory committee. So,
Harold, yeah. Question?
Yeah, two questions. So these point of entry systems would only be guaranteed down to 50 parts per billion total?
No, these point of entry systems, this was part of the treatment, the pilot study that PG&E did. And again, I haven't read the report, but the requirement was that they would treat hexavalent chromium, or deliver hexavalent chromium at less than detectable levels, which is 0.06.
And this RO system?
That's ion exchange.
The ion exchange. With the RO dealing with some of the other constituents at the faucet.
Okay, and then the deeper wells, I mean, what's the likelihood that this could set up more contamination of the lower aquifer or drawing water?
It obviously would depend on where these deeper wells were. In some cases, they may not be feasible. In some cases, they could be feasible. If you're talking about backup by the compressor station, you know, there is a pretty good clay layer in that area. And, you know, a municipal or domestic well is not going to pull that much. It's not like a agricultural well. So, but, you know, it's one of those things we have to look at. We just got the report Monday.
Right.
And it is something we want to look at is what are the risks of spreading contamination with deep wells and, you know, where they might be located and where they might be feasible and where they might not be.
So I would be concerned that in the discussions with the community that the community members be fully informed of all the pros and cons of the different options so that they can make an informed decision and that they aren't being led towards a solution that is economically beneficial to PG&E.
And one of the things we'd like to do is...
Necessarily.
Yeah. you know, as one of the other aspects of the cleanup order was... that, and we mentioned this to you before, but that PG&E is now paying for a consultant that is reporting to the advisory committee. And so we think that the consultant could be a resource that the community members could use to evaluate this report and help them reach a decision.
I just hope that staff will monitor that process to make sure that it really is transparent.
Yes.
Andrew? Mm-hmm. When is that next community meeting?
It's 2 weeks from weeks from tonight.
The 26th.
Yeah. So that's that item. The next item is item 8. It's the Antelope Valley Salt Nutrient Management Plan. This is the one that you had the presentation on in late 2011, and we've been giving you some ongoing status reports. I think the key thing that sort of called out in this one, which to us is relatively important, and I think you made comments about this both at the Mojave and the Antelope Valley stakeholder discussion, was that this needed to be a fully engaged stakeholder group. That was one of the key points that the board made during the discussion at both of these. And what this report indicates is that at least in the Antelope area, the farming community is not engaged yet in the salt nutrient management plan process, development process. And, you know, there have been some efforts to reach out to the farm community to get them, you know, to engage in the process. So far, those efforts have not been successful. I had a brief discussion with a few of the managers of the agencies that are working within the salt nutrient management plan, and you know they were pretty close to asking the regional board for some assistance to help engage the farming community. That they've tried to reach out. This indicates that they've made another attempt to reach out. So we're going to track this one pretty closely. I haven't thought too much about what that looks like. You know, I don't know what kind of regulatory role the board would have to try to engage stakeholders. But clearly, you know, from a end-of-the-day perspective without them being part of the process, I'm not sure the value of the salt nutrient management plan itself would have. And that may be the, you know, that may be the stick, frankly, is, you know, this is not going to work without that group being a participant. So we're gonna track this one pretty closely, and it may require some of my time in the near term to talk with the farming community and see what their issues are and find out a little bit more about their lack of desire to engage in this. You know, I can speculate that there may be something to do with the adjudication that's going on and issues with water quantity and how this might affect the future farming operations in the area. So the other point that I think is real important that's in here is the nature of water that's being recharged. And there's a little bit of discussion going on about the fact that many of the people in the community feel that you know, the major source of recharge to the area is up in the higher elevations around the valley rather than on the valley floor. And I think staff was correct in pointing out to them that, you know, due to the urbanization and due to some of the stormwater management requirements that are going into effect, there really is more stormwater that's being percolated within the valley itself, and that we need to understand that better, both from a quantity and a quality perspective. And I think the group realizes that and is willing to tackle that. So I think that's a great point that staff made in their discussions when during some of these meetings. Two other items. Item 10 is the Mojave Phase 2 stormwater permittees. And it's titled a little differently, but that's really the point that I want to talk about briefly here is, you know, in California and the nation, we have sort of two levels of municipal permittees under the stormwater program. The Phase 1 group are the stormwater municipalities of population greater than 100,000. And then below that, some municipalities qualify for Phase 2. Not all of them do, but some do, and a lot depends on population, on density of population, on growth rates, and a number of other things. But the key point to this is that the Phase 2 regulations have some very specific components to them. One is an outreach component, is to try to educate the public about what they do on a day-to-day basis that could affect quality of stormwater runoff. And I think this is a great example of where the municipalities have approached this in a way to try to reach out to the community, to try to educate them by getting them involved. And I think that's a great way of education, is involving the public rather than lecturing to them. I think people learn more by the involvement process. So I think this is a positive indication of these municipalities, you know, trying to embrace this and trying to move it forward. Obviously, this is just one aspect of it, but I think it's a good positive step. The last item that I wanted to cover in the written material is item 12, and the Air Force Base. And the only point I wanted to make here was that, you know, the board has adopted many records of decision over time, and I think this applies both to these record of decisions that are adopted through the Department of Defense program, but also through your cleanup programs. When you adopt a cleanup standard and a cleanup program, we all have to be prepared to say, is this really going to be the program forever, or are we willing to adapt if we learn new things about it? And I think this is a good example of where, you know, the Department of Defense has always indicated that their programs are reviewed every 5 years, and when new information comes forward, they're prepared to adapt to that. This is an example where new information came forward and the Department of Defense changed their remedy from a closure in place to a removal, where they would actually pick up all the material and move it off to an off-site location, which is a much better way of securing this type of facility. And the difference came up because the volume that was estimated initially turned out to be much higher than what actually existed. So it became cost-effective to do a removal action and move the material rather than try to cap it in place. So, you know, it's something that that you know, we should be more open to. And I think it goes for a lot of the cleanups that you're going to be asked to look at in the future is you do what you can with the information you have, but you need to set up regular adaptive management approaches, not every year because things don't change that quickly, but every 5 years or so, somebody needs to take a look and say, are we still on the right track? Have we learned something new that might cause us to change either our standard for cleanup or our methodology for cleanup? And the only other thing that I wanted to cover, actually there's two more things. One of them is something that the State Water Resources Control Board is working on right now, and it's on their April 17th board meeting agenda. They're going through what they're calling a resource alignment process. And I gave you the executive summary of the report that they're going to be looking at in this upcoming board meeting. What this was driven by was last year when the State Water Board adopted their new fee structure, a number of the stakeholders that pay fees on an annual basis were questioning the value of their fees. What were they getting in return for the fees that were being paid? You know, many of them indicated that they very rarely saw regional board people. You know, their permits hadn't been updated in 10 years. You know, they turn in inspection reports and they have no idea what happens to them. So the state board members, when they going along with the fee program that was proposed by staff, they also asked the staff to look at this and say, well, you know, what are we using these funds for? And that's really, I think, the genesis of this resource realignment or alignment effort that's going on right now is to demonstrate both internally and externally that we are using these fees to the highest priority programs that we have, and that, you know, they're not going to fund things outside of what the fee payer would expect those funds to be used for. So that's a program that's going on. I'm not going to go through it in general, but I think we'll hear more about this in the future. I think, you know, from our perspective at the Lahontan region, we've always done, a really good job of doing annual work plans that do look at aligning the fees that we get, the money that we get in certain programs, to the highest priority programs, priority activities within that program. And I think a lot of the other regional boards, or some of the other regional boards, don't do as detailed a review of that as I think we've done in the past few years. So I think we're well ahead of the game in terms of some of the information that's going to come out of this. The other aspect of this that I think we have to be concerned about is that this may be an effort towards, I'd say, more, I'll use the word bean counting in terms of, okay, we're giving you this many resources, we expect this many outputs, and again, losing track of the outcomes. And so I'm a little concerned about that. I think there's enough language in here that the State Board is acknowledging that, yes, we have permits that we have to renew, we have inspections we have to do, but we also have to pay attention to the outcome side of things, and that not all of our resources have to go to something that we can count as a widget at the end of the day. But we've got to be really careful about that we don't get too pulled into, you know, every hour has to have a check on a box and some output that results from it directly. So we'll see how this thing goes, and I'm sure it will come up at your next WQCC meeting. I think that's it.
Harold? Chuck Curtis, supervising engineer. I did a brief review of the report. One thing that they did identify that some dischargers will see as a positive and some definitely as a negative is that fees that are charged for some programs may have to increase significantly to cover the costs of regulating those programs, where some others may go down, but that was definitely something that was identified in the report.
well. Reports by the board chair and board members. I'll start with board members.
Did Lori have a report?
No, there's no report.
Nothing to report.
On March 26th, there was a chair EO meeting down in Sacramento, and there's just a few things to talk about. Basically, the water quality meeting will be in the first Thursday, Friday in November. There is a big discussion on the California Water Plan of 2013, which I'm not familiar with. And there was also a discussion of ex parte and legislation regarding that upcoming. I like it the way it is and express that opinion. That's one less meeting I have to worry about. There's also a great discussion on well testing at the time of sale when the well and the septic tank is on the same property. That's currently not being done, but some counties are moving in that direction. It makes perfect sense, you know, private domestic wells. Also, Lori, while I have the floor, we talked at our last meeting regarding solar and wind power generation. And we're looking at a future meeting. Have you sort of gotten the time down?
We're actually going to talk a little more. Well, I don't know if we're going to talk about this afternoon, but we're doing work planning for next fiscal year. So I brought it to Toby Tyler's and Jan Zimmerman's attention because they're the primary project folks that are working on alternative energy projects. So they have it on their plan, and we're looking at probably the fall, you know, the September board meeting, because we don't meet in August, and that they would give a presentation to the board. And so any specific things you want us to highlight, I mean, we wanted to share, obviously, all the projects that we've been involved with and what are some of the examples of the kinds of BMTs or mitigation that we've been requiring or the way we look at planning and design and implementation of those projects. So they're both starting to, you know, pull some photos together, and they've got their tables of projects, so that's what we're shooting for at this point.
Any questions?
No.
Well, the last item is adjournment. Unless anyone objects, we'll adjourn.